Tonight on The Download, from the Museum of Contemporary Art, Chief Curator Michael Darling, hip-hop producer Odd Couple, and another installment of The Swap Meet with Greg Flam. Now, here's your host, a man who thought ransomware was a new clothing line from Mel Gibson, Justin Kaufman.
Where's my son?
I'm like, that's a nice leather jacket. I wish I could get the leather jacket that Mel Gibson has in the movie Ransom. Ransomware, right? I'll click this link. Welcome to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, back for another night. Exciting to be here. Beautiful night, although there's some weather coming through the area. Tornado watches, of course. We'll keep you up to date on all of that tonight. Rob's got it. He's watching right now. Wow, we are on the air till 11 o'clock tonight. I'm excited to be here. We got a great show lined up tonight. Mike Fouché will be here first off, right after the 7:30 news, so we can talk about what's happening in Springfield. What have the two parties compromised on today? Hello? Anybody? Anything? Talk about Springfield and whether or not we're going to see a budget by Friday. Governor Rauner, of course, threatening to keep lawmakers past the deadline, which pretty much tells us that the deadline doesn't mean anything. That's the thing that scares you the most. Talk with Mike Fouché about that and some other issues that are happening in the Chicago area, including a soda tax and the resistance against the soda tax here in Cook County, which is supposed to start on July 1st. What's going to happen? Talk with Mike about that. Coming up at 8 o'clock, we'll talk with Michael Darling. He's the chief curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art. He's also the curator of the new Takashi Murakami exhibit, The Octopus Eats Its Own Leg. It's amazing. I think I'm going to go back there this weekend. It's so good. This artist, Murakami, is not a new artist. He's been around forever, and he's done things. So he was they did the Kanye West graduation album. The album cover. He's also done a ton of stuff where you've seen in commercial work. But this is just such an undertaking. It's amazing. The attention to detail. And I mean, it's, you know, that scene from Ferris Bueller when Cameron's looking at the painting in the Art Institute and he keeps going and it keeps going. This is like this, but it just never stops. Your eyes start to train and look, and you see circles and then squares and diamonds. And I mean, it's really, really intense. A great exhibit, The Octopus Eats Its Own Leg. And don't take my word for it. Take Bono's word for it. As the exhibit is attracting a celebrity crowd. U2 when they were in town. Chance the Rapper. Many others. So we'll talk with Michael Darling about what makes this exhibit so successful. Also coming up tonight, we'll talk Warrior Games. Also, Odd Couple's going to be here, the hip-hop producer who's going to be playing Summerfest over the 4th of July holiday. I think on the actual 4th. Odd Couple has worked with pretty much all of the hip-hop artists that have come out of Chicago, including Chance the Rapper. He did a lot of stuff for Acid Rap, the first album or mixtape that Chance the Rapper put out. We'll talk with Odd Couple about his philosophy when it comes to producing music, what he does to get the right sound, not just with the beats that he produces, but the artists that he works with. It's coming up tonight. And Greg Flam's going to be here. Love when Greg's in the house. Do Swap Meet tonight, 312-981-7200. You got something down in the basement, maybe up in the attic, hanging on the living room wall? Well, give us a call. Text us, let us know, and we'll tell you what it's worth. Pretty simple concept. Greg Flam in studio tonight. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download. Show about Chicago starring those who know it well. Take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right. So Download here on 720 WGN until 11 o'clock tonight. Let's start with the carryout. All right. Here are today's top stories. Springfield showdown. T-minus 2 days. So do we have a budget? No. Did anything happen today? No. Are we going to wait till 11:30 p.m. on the 30th? Probably. After the Democrats released a spending plan yesterday, all eyes turned to the Republicans who said, well, how are you going to pay for it? That's when Speaker Madigan was like, gosh, do I have to do everything? Yeah, well, you do. That's your job. Actually, today was a day of action, but not of compromise. The Democrats passed their versions of pension reform and workers' comp reform, and Republicans quickly said they were all fake and not at all reform. We've been down this road. I mean, the property tax freeze didn't even get enough votes. So what's happening? Here are two ways that this thing is going. Are Democrats faking compromise and just taking Rauner's agenda items and passing bills that don't do what the governor asks? Or are the Democrats passing bills that the governor's asking for, but the governor and Republicans are unwilling to meet in the middle? That's But I guess that's the issue. And that's my issue the entire time. You have a governor who has certain reforms and won't budge on them. And even though the House and the Senate are Democrat majority, way majority, so doesn't that automatically mean compromise has to happen? I mean, I would think 12-year-olds know that. No? No. I thought I had it. I guess we lost it right there at the end. Governor Rauner doesn't seem to be too concerned with the looming deadline. He threatened to keep lawmakers in special session past the Friday deadline if they don't get a deal done. Oh, joy. As the state budget showdown gets tighter and more important, the Chicago City Council must have felt the pressure to do some substantive work today, so they went ahead and passed an ordinance to tighten the rules on massage therapy. I know this is really a crackdown on prostitution. I get it, and that's important. But doesn't this just scream of an alderman who got a bad massage and was like, yeah, you know, we got to do something about this. I mean, that oil was cold and hot at the same time, and I think the lady hurt my shoulder. We need an ordinance now. Schools, violence, taxes, they got to go. New priority. Massages. That's my alderman voice. What do you think?
Gavel.
All right, well, we solved it. Violence is fixed thanks to the mayor who ordered the closure of an underpass that connects the lakefront to the Streeterville neighborhood. Some aldermen are calling out a double standard, saying if we close the street every time someone was shot, we would have to shut down 600 streets by now. The Ohio Street underpass connects to a very wealthy area, and the city's move to close it off is in reaction to a shooting there earlier this month. It does beg the question, what's next? If there's an expressway shooting, do we close down the Ike early? If there's a stabbing on the south side, do we just close Ashland from 11 to 7? I guess the big question is, what authority does the city have to shut down access to parts of the city? I guess they can do whatever they want, which, let's be clear, the Ohio Street underpass used to be closed at night. So I don't even know. At a certain point, you're like, when did it get open? And then it became like, damn, yes, I'm getting things done. I'm closing it again. It's almost like someone forgot to lock it, right? I think that's what we're seeing is somebody's job, and they're like, oh, right, I do that every Tuesday. I'm sorry, that's my bad. Still, interesting, right? I mean, that's a question. Are we going to start seeing things closed down because of crime and violence? Anyway, more important news. New flu shot technology. Yes, scientists say that the shot may be the thing of the past thanks to a new invention, which is a patch. A bandage that you put on your arm like you're trying to quit cigarettes. Awesome. Why stop there? I'm hungry. I'm tired. I'm frisky. There's a patch for that. But even then, you know that bandage is still going to hurt when you try to rip it off. So why don't you work on that technology, big science? In weather, finally a little rain today. I knew it was too good to be true. Although hot again, which means tornado watches, so watch out. In sports, the Cubs had quite a day. Let's start with their trip to the White House to visit the president. Only the Cubs get two visits to two different presidents for the same win, right? Trump seemed giddy to have him, but was I the only one that thought that he treated the Cubs players like little kids? You guys want to see the Oval Office, huh? Why don't you hop up here and we'll do some individual photos? That's what he said. It's like the Cubs were there because they sold the most candy bars. Trump went on to say that the Cubs were a great team, although after he said, they're doing okay, but from this point out, you guys are going to be great. You're going to be great, right? Motivation. Now watch, the Cubs are going to rattle off 30 in a row. The media said it couldn't be done. CNN, NBC, CBS, nobody. They said it couldn't, but Trump, he knew. Cubs are getting blown out right now. The Rickets were loving it, though, and so was Cleveland Cavaliers owner Dan Gilbert, who was not only there but got called out by the president for no real apparent reason. See that guy? That's Dan Gilbert. Then Trump went on to point out others in the audience, again, treating all players like 12-year-olds. Do you know who that is? He actually said, do you know who that is? That's a very important senator. Okay. Albin Amora is like, who? What? And then my favorite part is he said, hold up, I got one piece of business. Then we'll go in the back and slap each other with towels. Healthcare, unbelievable. Going to surprise everybody. USA, thank you for being here. I mean, he wasn't even asked a question about it. It was a very nonsensical moment. Didn't seem like he even knew what baseball was. It seemed like the only thing he knew less about than baseball was healthcare. Of course, many of the Cubs weren't there. Jason Hayward, Addison Russell, Strope-a-dope. Carl Edwards Jr. told his son Times he opted to do some sightseeing, like he wanted to see the Dinosaur Museum. What? The Dinosaur Museum? What you? Oh, you mean the Capitol Building. Got it. Whatever. Jake Arrieta didn't show either, which I give him the most credit because he didn't show up for Obama either. So, and he didn't show up last night either. So there you go. On that point, after the loss last night where the Nationals stole 7 bases on Arrieta and catcher Miggy Montero, Montero threw Arrieta under the bus saying it was Jake's fault, not his. This prompted Rizzo to take shots on the radio this morning. And a couple hours later, Miguel Montero, he gone, cut. So there you have it. I guess he's not going to be leading off anytime soon. Hopefully the absence of Montero and the motivation of Trump will turn this season around. Speaking of showing up, Lackey did show up to the White House today, but he did not show up tonight, getting shellacked. What happened to that Trump pep talk? I thought this was it. On the South side, starting off a little slow for Carlos Rodon, who is in trouble in the first inning. Loaded up, already down 1-0. They won in a walk-off last night. They continue tonight. This is Carlos Rodon's first start of the year. Hopefully not as bad as he was in AAA, but it's looking like it is going to be. Even with the win yesterday, the White Sox are not only in last place in the AL Central, but they have the worst record in all of the American League. So there you have it. Huge NBA news today. Phil Jackson fired in New York at the Knicks. He was terrible there. But hey, not terrible enough to take over for Gar Forman. Seriously, who wouldn't want the Zen master in the front office here in Chicago? I know the NBA hates him right now because they love when a contrarian gets his, but, I mean, is there any better coach in Chicago sports history? I mean, he's got 9 championships. It's crazy. Bring him here, let him screw it up. Who cares, right? What's going to happen? Is he going to tick off Zach LaVine? Who cares? Also, the Houston Rockets traded for Chris Paul today. They're making moves to be a super team down in Houston. There's even word that they have money left over to make a run at Paul George. Now, that's what I call a rebuild. There's no rebuilding in the NBA, just superstar free agents going to play with other superstar free agents, right? Whatever. And finally tonight, inventors are working on a robot gripper to clean up space debris. I guess that's an issue with junk and former satellites and leftover Flaming Hot Cheeto bags in space. Maybe not the last one, but seriously, you're working on a robot gripper for space? How about one for my couch that's super long that could reach the fridge? But I guess if we had one of those, we'd just stop having kids. That's the carryout for June 28, 2017. Hey, sorry for the wait on your order. I'm telling you that it's a problem in the kitchen, but you know what? I just forgot to put it in. My bad. Have a bottle of Diet Right on me. All right, coming up, Mike Fouché is going to be here. We'll talk what happened in Springfield today. We'll also talk about resistance to the soda tax. Also, some moves for public comments at City Hall. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Not a great start for Carlos Rodon on the south side. Already gave up 3 runs.
Negative. Bad start.
3 walks in the first inning. This is his first start.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if there's a lot of criticism over his pitching later tonight. If
the no-name, I don't even know who the catcher's name is on the White Sox.
I'm sorry.
He's going to get in the locker room and be like, yeah. You know, he just wasn't throwing strikes.
I'll tell you, I'm giving
Rodon's fault.
So down and away. It's high and tight. What are you doing? Yikes. Baseball in the city. Yeah. I'll love it.
And that'll be the end of the White Sox news for the night.
So I get home last night and I turn on ESPN's Sports Center and I see Miggy going off on Arrieta.
Did you know it was going to happen?
Yeah. I said to myself, this is not good for Miggy.
Oh, man. Yeah. How can you believe that?
But Kyle was right. I mean, in the way that it's probably the right move, but if it was anyone who was actually producing, and like if it was, imagine if it was Jason Hayward or something, he'd never do that, but they're not gonna cut a guy who's actually in the
lineup.
Yeah,
but wasn't he sightseeing today?
No, that was Carl Edwards.
That was Carl Edwards. That's right, yeah.
I'm going to go to the Dinosaur Museum.
Yeah, I want to see a bunch of bleach, white, old bones, so I went to the Senate today.
There it is.
Boom.
Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. Mike Fouché in studio for his Wednesday night check-in from the Daily Line. Talk all things Chicago, Cook County, and Springfield. Mike, good to see you.
It's awesome.
I'm sorry about that.
Oh, thanks, I didn't even turn me on.
I didn't even try.
I'll, like, yell across the room at you.
There's times when I'll miss a button. I didn't even try. You know, it's like, Mike's not talking
I think
tonight.
That was Freudian. Who needs it?
I get off the air with Pete, and I'm like, this is Fouché. He talks too much. We're going to do something about this.
Can we change that to he talks too much, he never shuts up? Yeah, we'll do that.
All right, let's talk about Springfield. When we start there, as we saw yesterday, the Democrats put forth a spending plan. Now, this was something that was less money than what Republicans had said.
Well, let's be clear here. The House, it was right? Speaker Madigan.
Speaker Madigan put forth a spending plan out of the House, yeah. Which was less than what the Senate plan was, and also less than what the Rauner
had. Less spending than the Rauner.
Right, yeah. So that's a good thing, right?
Less spending than last year. Yeah, that's great, right? Yeah, done. All right, bye, everybody. We win. Illinois wins. Fireworks go off. It's the best. Right.
What's it really mean?
I mean, what it means is that this is just one of the many things, which is really what we've always been talking about is really not the budget. It's all the, quote, off-budget items, right? I mean, Governor Rauner has his turnaround agenda, which none of which have anything to do with the budget. He wants property tax freeze. He wants term limits, but you know, workers' comp reform. He's pretty much given up the stuff except for a workers' comp reform and a property tax freeze. But then last week, Speaker Madigan said, hey, remember me, guys? I got some stuff of my own. And he came up with some of his own off-budget items. One is to include the passage of a school funding reform.
One that's out, Senate Bill 1.
Right. And then his own ideas for workers' comp reform, which is completely different than what it is that Bruce Rauner has suggested.
Now, of course, when cynics look at this, I mean, this seems to be sort of thumbing his nose at the governor, saying, I have my own items, too. If you want to negotiate, I have my off-budget items as well.
Well, you know, here's the thing is that when you are preparing to negotiate, one of the things that you need to do is you need to know what it is that you're willing to give up. You need to know what it is that you have to have. And I think that, you know, by larding up the table, you had more things.
Mike, let me just stop you real quick. Let's go to Rob Martyr. He's got an update on the weather. What do you got, Rob?
Yeah, guys, real quick. National Weather Service in Chicago issuing a tornado warning for central Winnebago County. This will be in effect until 8 tonight. This is a severe thunderstorm. Also, the radar indicating rotation in this one as well. A dangerous storm will be in the Rockford area in about the next 7 to 10 minutes. So if you're in that area, please take shelter. Again, this is from the National Weather Service. This is a tornado warning for central Winnebago County in effect until about 8 tonight. We will keep you posted.
We definitely will. Thanks, Rob, as we pay attention. And wow. Of course, a tornado warning means, you know, take
Go
cover.
Go to your basement.
Yeah. This will be that area for Winnebago County. All right. So as we picked right back up, the idea of as this really is, I guess, the beginnings of what we consider to be a negotiation.
Right. And you know, there's still a few days left. I mean, June 30th is the big day, right? Saturday, or no, Friday. Saturday. Saturday is the big day. And that's the day, you know, after June 30th, what has become very clear is the bond rating agencies have said, if you don't pass a budget, we're going to cut it to junk. We're going to cut Illinois' ratings, bond ratings to junk, which is going to be devastating.
What do you make of the idea that, I mean, the governor said today that he's willing to keep legislators there even if they don't hit the deadline, which makes me think that he's not as concerned about this deadline, which would be on Friday. But the idea being, you know.
Well, let's game this out a little bit, right? Okay, so Saturday is June 30th.
Friday is June 30th.
Nope. Yeah, Friday is June 30th. Yeah, okay, I've got to look at the calendar.
It's all good.
Friday is June 30th, right? And then pretty much for the next 4 days, everything really shuts down, okay? Saturday,
for the holiday, right?
There's nothing going on Saturday. There's nothing going on Sunday. Monday, you know, the banks are going to be closed. So that's the 3rd. The 4th, stuff is going to be closed. So that means on the 5th is really the day when the guillotine comes down. So, yeah, you know, maybe Governor Rauner does keep everybody over the July 4th holiday, which would be excruciating and horrible for everybody that's a legislator.
Or, you know, or covers the legislator.
Or covers the legislator. Yeah.
That's probably more apt. You know, as we get closer to the, I mean, when Madigan puts out a spending plan, and we saw today, and I mentioned in the beginning, the idea that a workers' comp reform package passed the House.
Right.
So did a... what was the? There was another one that passed the House, another one of these that had to do with reform.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, are they the compromise that the governor wants? He says he wants something on workers' comp. He wants something on
pension reform.
Pension
as
reform.
Well.
That's what passed.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah.
That are
there
these,
are a number
are,
of pension reforms
are these,
that passed the House.
Are these those compromise? I mean, is this
no?
Is this a,
no.
What,
no. It's
what's
not
happened?
What it is
what
he
passed
wants.
Today.
I mean, it's funny what it is that Rauner really wants for pension reform. I mean, when people say pension reform, it gets put in a lot of different ways. I mean, basically what we've been doing here in Illinois for, quote, pension reform is that we've been extending out the payment periods. It's sort of like you have a loan on your car that's a 5-year loan, and then you say, oh, I'm going to make it a 6-year loan. So the payments get a little smaller and stretched out over time. That's what we've been doing for our pension payments. And Rauner has said, no, I don't want to do that. We need to figure out something else. And what Bruce Rauner really means is that he wants to cut benefits for people that have pensions because he believes that the pension benefits are too big and in the future they need to be smaller.
So is that, are you saying anything short of that in terms of pension reform that passes the House is not going to satisfy the governor?
It's hard to say what will exactly satisfy the governor because he has not really spelled it out in so many words. I mean, essentially what he's making everybody do is kind of guesstimate what it is exactly that he wants. After 2 years of trying to work it out, I think we're beginning to get an idea of what it is that he really wants, which is less benefits for people that have pensions. But the state Supreme Court has said
right.
You can't really cut benefits for people that already have – there's already been contractual agreements for these people. So I think that what Rauner is really looking for is for new future employees to get even fewer benefits.
Mike Fouché with the Daily Line in studio as he is every Wednesday. We'll take a quick break, come back. We got to talk about soda tax.
Yeah, right.
And let's talk about some movement in the city council for public comments.
Yeah.
Mike Fouché, my guest. Stay with us. Like I said, we're watching the severe weather that's heading through Rockford area, Winnebago County, North Boone. Mike Fouché in studios. We also talk politics tonight. Mike, let's make a transition from Springfield to Cook County. The soda tax, a big deal here. Looked like it was it's going to start July 1st, but there's been a lot more sort of pushback and resistance than they thought.
Yeah, so let's be clear here. This is the sugar sweetened beverage tax.
Right.
So I mean, it's a lot of stuff besides soda. And essentially, you're going to be paying a tax, a per-ounce tax on buying the soda, and it was supposed to come into effect on July 1st. And retailers have just been really upset about it because they don't really have a good way of implementing collecting the tax. Their cash register systems, NCR, says we don't have a way in order to register the number of ounces per sold with items.
Yeah.
And we can't really collect this stuff very easily. And so retailers are absolutely freaking out.
What does the county say to that? I mean, what
do
they say?
The county says, you know, fine, you guys figure it out. You know, you can work it out, no problem. They've worked it out in other cities. So the Illinois Merchant Retailers Association, which is the big trade association for retailers, has filed a suit, a temporary restraining order, in order to try and hold the thing off. And today, they filed the suit yesterday. Today, the judge that was assigned to the case actually recused herself, and so there's another judge. Don't really know why the judge recused themselves, but you know now we have a new judge. We're supposed to have a hearing tomorrow. It's possible that they'll say, okay, we're gonna hold it. It's not going to be implemented on July 1st. There's a lot. I mean, there was a protest on Tuesday. There were a few hundred people that showed up at the James R. Thompson Center downtown. There is a lot of resistance to this sugar-sweetened beverage tax.
The president, President Preckwinkle, came on and said, you know, she told the media, hey, if you want good government, there's got to be more taxes. This is something that's being done in a lot of different places. I mean, it is something that we, even on our airwaves, you've seen resistance. But, I mean, is it something that follows in the same footsteps as a lot of other municipalities around the country?
Philadelphia is doing it. And there's a lot of different stories that both sides have about whether or not Philadelphia has been successful or not. But I think the key thing here for retailers is that in Philadelphia, after they instituted their sugar sweetened beverage tax, the amount of sugar sweetened beverages that sold declined by about 30% in the city of Philadelphia.
Which is part of the intention of this, right?
Well, I mean, it is a little bit of a nanny tax to a certain extent. But the other thing that really upsets these retailers is that, you know, if you're 7-Eleven, 30% of your sales of, Loco, Five Loco is kind of a big deal. I mean, that's a lot of money for you.
Right.
That's basically what you sell on summer afternoons. So, you know, these guys are pretty upset about it.
Is there any way that it gets pushed back, that July 1st, we don't see this tax going to effect on the 1st?
We're
going to
know tomorrow. I mean, tomorrow, I think it's tomorrow afternoon, there's going to be a hearing, and the judge will make a decision whether or not she's going to institute a temporary restraining order. And then we'll see what happens. I mean, after that, you know, I think that it will then grind through the process. If the judge doesn't have a temporary restraining order, there could still be a separate hearing about whether or not it should be halted. You know, the barrier for a temporary restraining order is typically, is there some sort of injury that is going to be occurring to people? And the argument that Illinois Merchant Retailers Association is making is, yes, there is an injury because we're going to be breaking the law because we're not able to actually implement this at cash registers around the county.
Mike, let's finish up public comments at city council meetings. This is something that is new. Talk about this. Is this something that is going to change the way that the city council does government?
Yeah, this is crazy, right? So before every major city council meeting, there's going to be 30 minutes of comment. Individuals will have 3 minutes to make their comments. So that means 10 people can make a comment. They put this big red LED glowing shot clock in the middle of the city council chambers in order to track everybody's time. But, you know, really what this is all about is that there's really one guy who has really made this into an issue. And that guy is an individual named George Blakemore. And George Blakemore, he talks and talks and talks. And, you know, people shut him down regularly. Sometimes he has really good things to say. Sometimes he doesn't. City Council is very concerned about managing this guy. The people who filed the suit, they were attempting to protest something last June, and they were kicked out of the city council chamber because the city council really, you know, kind of packed the chamber with people that were sympathetic to what it is that they were trying to do. So, you know, there's new rules about seating in city council. You call ahead to get seats, and they will reserve seats for you. And then you have an opportunity to speak before every city council meeting. It means it's going to be a lot longer and slower. Just like county board meetings, they have these long comment periods. But truthfully, the real long thing that takes a long time in city council is they have all these honorary resolutions.
I call it the Ed Burke hour.
It's not just him, but there's a lot of stuff.
Mike Fouché from the Daily Line joins us every Wednesday. You can also follow the podcast, the Aldercast, which is on Fridays. You get at WGN Plus. Mike, great to see you.
Great to be here.
Welcome back to the Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the Museum of Contemporary Art has another hit on its hands. The new exhibit from famed Japanese artist Takashi Murakami is called The Octopus Eats Its Own Leg. It's a retrospective of the pop artist whose work has graced commercials and album covers like Kanye West's Graduation. But it's more than that. It's more than pop art. On display at the MCA, you spot an attention to detail, an amazing patterns, layers, colors, and designs, and a tremendous process to put together to work. It's simply exquisite. The exhibit is bringing celebrity to Chicago to see it, like when U2 was just in town, and that's good for an art museum. It's a way for Chicago to compete with other cities who may attract viral hits for ice cream or polka dots. Joining me tonight to talk about Murakami's work, but also the business of viral art and art exhibits, is Michael Darling. He's the James W. Alsdorf Chief Curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art, a position he's had since 2010.
Yes.
Michael Darling, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to talk to you the minute I walked into this exhibit. It's tremendous. I mean, the work and the attention to detail is just so striking. What drew you to the work, and why bring Murakami's work to the MCA?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you recognize that, because that was what I was really hoping to deliver to people, because I've known him for quite a while. I worked with him originally back in 2000 and 2001, and already then kind of built up an amazing affinity for his work and an appreciation for what he did, but always felt that he was slightly misunderstood, or that people didn't recognize the depth of his work. And then I was in his studio in 2013 and saw the newest works being made, and this with this new kind of process where he's using lots of silk screens and things. And that's when it just really blew me away. And I thought, you know, I want to bring this to Chicago. People need to know about this. And then so we've been working since then to make this happen.
Do you say misunderstood because he's known as a commercial artist, or the idea that he's a crossover celebrity artist?
Yeah, I think the crossover part is definitely very intentional on his part. But people recognize him for the happy poppy stuff, the flowers, the Louis Vuitton bags,
which is
important. But there's this other aspect of his work that's really serious, really where he's really thinking hard about what Japan is like after World War II, how Japan was affected psychologically by the bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And so there's this depth to the work, and as you noticed, a craft that I think people miss when they're just sort of seeing, you know, emoji-type things
up everywhere. It's a great exhibit because you really do, you know, it almost goes through his career, and it shows and explains the career trajectories and the transitions, the points when he says, I don't want to do album covers. I don't want to just be known for this. And he makes a transition into taking on issues like death and the sculpture work that he does in the piece. And talk about that. Talk about when you have an artist like Murakami who is known in the art world for one certain thing and you want to present more. What are the challenges in doing that? Because people who know his work, they want to see the Kanye West cover, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the thing that was exactly the challenge that I feel like I faced with this and with him. And so I decided to mostly focus on the paintings, kind of trying to strip away some of the more of the sculpture, strip away kind of ideas about like the Louis Vuitton collaborations, and really thought that if people looked at the evolution of the paintings from the beginning to the present, mm-hmm. that might be a way to get people to look at his work a little bit more differently. And so we've got paintings from very, very early in his career, which I really had to twist his arm to include those, but it shows...
He didn't want to do that?
No, he didn't at all. I mean, I think because he's come so far since then.
But that's the beauty of it, to see, I mean, even some of the stuff that is not, I mean, it's not as poppy, it's just a piece of art that you're like, oh, well, that seems like a little bit more standard than the stuff that he's known for.
Yeah, yeah. And those early works really show his Japanese training, too, especially in this technique called Nihonga that he actually even earned a PhD in, which people don't know. And the, one of the nice things that I've heard from people, too, is they feel like it's maybe empowering to younger artists or young people where they say, oh, my gosh, this is where he started, where, like you said, it's kind of there's a certain humbleness to those early pieces that that are so far from where he is now.
When you're a curator and you want to do an exhibit, especially with famous artists like Murakami, I mean, how much of it is do you present your vision and how you want to present his artwork, and how much is he like, no, I don't want to do that? Like, I mean, is that essentially how an exhibit comes together?
Yeah, I think those negotiations definitely happen a lot. And in this case, I think I was presenting something to him that was slightly unconventional, and I was trying to kind of prove a certain kind of point. And I probably would have been less successful if we hadn't had this ongoing and longstanding relationship where I think he trusted me. He knew that I wasn't going to try to put him in a bad light and that I was really trying to accomplish
because a lot of it is I have new work, show the new work. We don't have to go backwards. This is, like I said, it's kind of a retrospective in the way that you're showing his entire career. But an artist, especially when they just finish new pieces, they're like, just show the new stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. And that's where me kind of trying to bring my kind of historian's lens to this and kind of convince them, like, no, I really think people want to see this early work and see where it started and take you through this journey. And And he, you know, those early pieces actually fell off the checklist at one point because he was too embarrassed by them, or some people were whispering in his ear, don't show these. And then I kind of was able to get them back on the checklist. So there's definitely a lot of back and forth between us to kind of build that trust.
The octopus eats its own leg. It's great because after I saw the exhibit, I did a little Google searching, and I was like looking at that phrase. And it's this idea that the octopus, when bored, will eat its own leg. Like, it actually will be like, there's times when it's in it, when it's, I don't know if it's bored or depressed or what happens, but that's a thing in nature. And you think about this being called The Octopus Eats Its Own Leg, and the transition in his career from wanting to get out of something or wanting to break free or move from what he's known for, or even being bored in the confines of what people know him as. It all kind of comes together. Am I wrong on that?
No, you're absolutely right. And,
yes,
you know, it's a biological fact, but it also is that the Japanese have kind of embraced that as almost like a folk saying, too, that to kind of address any situation where maybe there are challenges, you need to make certain sacrifices in order to move on to the next phase. And so he saw that as like a metaphor for his work and how he sometimes cannibalizes maybe his own work in order to move on to another spot.
Michael Darling's the curator of the new exhibit, the Takashi Murakami exhibit, The Octopus Eats Its Own Leg, at the Museum of Contemporary Art, running through September. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue. I want to talk about contrast and just the work itself. I mean, there's a lot of videos throughout the exhibit where you can actually see how he puts the pieces together. And I want to know how much of that is standard procedure for contemporary artists and how much of that is particular or unique to Murakami's work. Michael Darling in studio. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, the MCA curator, the James W. Alsdorf chief curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art, Michael Darling. He is the curator of The Octopus Eats Its Own Leg, the retrospective of Takashi Murakami's work, his career, as you said, like from the beginning days to the newest work. I mean, it's amazing how many people are coming through the doors of the Museum of Contemporary Art. I mean, thousands on a weekend. This is a bona fide hit for you guys at the museum.
Yeah, and you know, we're only 2 weeks in, but we're at like 200% of our estimates on attendance, and the audience is totally young and totally diverse. And but also,
did you think that was going to be the case?
I mean, I definitely hope that it would. And this kind of a show that has broad appeal, we like to put these kinds of shows in the summertime when we have our biggest sort of audiences and where we, you know, the widest kind of audience, you know, where they could be quite general audience members, maybe the people that don't know so much about contemporary art. We thought this could lure them in and then hopefully teach them something when they get there. But it's, yeah, the response has been phenomenal so far, way beyond what we expected.
And you know, I think about the nature of a Museum of Contemporary Art, and I kind of mentioned in the lead just about, you know, that seems to be part of the business structure now, to have a viral hit that celebrities will come to, that, you know, like there may be more of a pop attraction or crossover in the way that, you know, it's Instagram posts and other things saying I was at the MCA in Chicago. Coming off the heels of David Bowie, having this exhibit, which is already, you know, on its way to being a viral success, like I mentioned, you two other artists and celebrities coming through there. I mean, is that the business model at this point for a Museum of Contemporary Art, to try and find these areas that are going to cross over into pop art success?
I mean, I don't think it's something that works for every museum and every contemporary museum. I think it's something that's sort of inherent in our DNA as a museum, where from the beginning we've presented performance, we've presented music, dance, theater, as well as visual arts. And then increasingly as time has gone on, architecture, design, things like that. So every now and then we love to cross over into those fields beyond straight visual arts. But like I said, in the summertime, we also are looking for these kinds of shows that really could open up a lot of different programmatic kind of angles, or open up the circus tent a little bit to bring more people in and give them a certain access point that maybe they wouldn't if it was just abstract paintings.
Or people who aren't going to go to the MCA.
Yeah. But the trick, I think, is finding something that has this broad appeal, but that we also can feel absolutely proud of in terms of having real art integrity, real relevance to what's going on today. And that was, you know, we definitely kind of wrestled with that with ourselves with Bowie. But then we said, no, this show is relevant. His career is all about the things that the MCA is about. And then you add on things like gender fluidity and ideas about identity and all of that. And so we just really hit the sweet spot. And then I think with Murakami, too, he's also – there's still a real fascination with him among young audiences and especially kind of urban audiences that are also, you know, interested in hip-hop and sneakers and skateboarding and, you know, street art.
Right,
and
right.
So he kind of crosses over into that territory, too, in a way that that I think, you know, we thought also thought was attractive.
I mean, it's really interesting because when you think of a museum, you definitely want these hits. And when you think of what you guys have done in the last couple of years with David Bowie and with this, I mean, the idea of bringing hip-hop culture into the MCA or David Bowie into the MCA, you're right. I think there is a little bit of a, is this the right fit for a museum? But I think that's why you guys are having success, is that you are pushing the boundary and trying new things, and it's working in the sense that everyone from Chance the Rapper to U2 are coming out and taking Instagram photos of, look where I'm at. I'm at the cool place. I'm at the MCA.
And I think that one of the reasons, too, is that Murakami was a real pioneer in this whole crossover kind of move. When he first did Louis Vuitton bags in the early 2000s, it almost was like the death knell of his career. Like the art world thought, oh my gosh, how could you possibly do this? He said that his auction prices went down and all kinds of things. But now it's standard operating procedure. And he's went for that risk and leveraged himself in that way and went out on a limb. And now other people are doing it. And I mean, I've heard from, you know, people that creative types that have come up in Chicago and they first learned about Murakami, not from the MCA, but from the Louis Vuitton store. You know, so reaching out in these more democratic ways through different channels is a really legitimate way of working these days. He was there first.
You know, we'll get back to Murakami's work, but I mean, he is really a study in contrast. And there's a lot of the East meets West, ancient versus modern. You guys kind of point that out. But it's also the commercial versus art. And as you mentioned, the art world. And I don't know much about the art world. But, I mean, is there sort of a hold the nose up when it comes to artists who've had commercial success, who do album covers or do things that are commercial in stores and things like that? Does the art world look down upon that?
I mean, I think they used to. And I think Murakami has kind of smoothed the way for that. I mean, now you have somebody like Sterling Ruby doing collaborations with Raf Simons, first at Christian Dior and now at Calvin Klein and other things like that, that where you see that crossover. But I think, you know, if you really think about it, the art world is about maintaining a certain exclusivity, and whether it's about prices, keeping prices, you know, high and protected, you know, protecting the exclusivity of what's in a museum collection or in a private collector's collection. And if you start democratizing that too much and making, you know, watering it down, it kind of, you can see how that might affect the economics of the whole thing. But Murakami has kind of made that okay. And I think it's because he's Japanese. I mean, he's trying to suggest that there's not such a distinction in Japanese culture maybe between those different disciplines. And so he's flattening all of those things out.
Yeah, right, right.
So he'll make a painting that'll sell for millions of dollars and then also a $5 keychain. And for him, they're the same, almost, not really the same. But, you know, he's trying to kind of force the dialogue to say that what's the difference between these things.
Well, for you at the Museum of Contemporary Art, where do museums fall into the art world? Because I would assume when you're talking about collectors and all the other things of being able to, you know, sell and buy art, that there may be like a look down upon Louis Vuitton bags. But what role does the museum have? I mean, because there was a point in the past, I would assume, that they wouldn't even look at a Murakami.
That's this great contrast that you're talking about, because I think the MCA, we do own Murakami in our collection. He's somebody that still has absolute street cred in the rarefied world of the art world. And his paintings are hanging on the walls of all the big museums in the world. You know, we have a painting on view right now that's from the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and it was just on their walls recently, or the Broad Museum in Los Angeles, or the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art.
So that's an easier draw.
He's there already. He's protected, but he's kind of embraced this as part of his whole artistic program and kind of concept, rather than it looking like kind of a cheap way to kind of knock stuff off and make more money. So he's kind of made it a concept, like a total.
Like, I'm going to be in all these museums.
And that I'm also going to do T-shirts and keychains, and that's part of what I do.
Does he open the door? I mean, his success and having that crossover appeal to contrast once again with the, you know, the rarefied air that is the art world and a street culture that's like, oh, great, one of ours is in the museum. Does he open the door for museums across the world to start looking at other artists, contemporary artists that never really fit inside the box that museums were celebrating before?
Yeah, I think he absolutely has. And I think one good example is the artist that goes by the name of Kaws, K-A-W-S, who really kind of came up through the street culture, skate culture kind of world, and now is making paintings, you know, that are unique pieces and making sculptures that are unique. And he's having museum shows, and he really looks at Murakami as a peer or a mentor in a way. I think you start to see somebody like Hebrew Brantley here in
yeah,
Chicago,
right.
Also that's sort of building this sort of grassroots kind of reputation and working in murals and now making toys and things like that, and then also trying to use that as a way to then kind of penetrate the upper echelons of the art world. So I think Murakami's a great example for that. Although he kind of did it the reverse way. He kind of started in the rarefied art world and then started trickling down.
Yeah, came back out.
So it's a slightly different model.
You know, it's I mean, for you as you've been in this job for a while here at the MCA, but being a part of the art world for decades, I mean, do you see a changing of the guard when it comes to, you mentioned Hebrew Brantley, others, where, you know, to be a successful artist in this day, it's not just about a great piece of art that the art world loves, but there is this viral kind of sensation that it's how many followers they have on social media, or it's almost like it almost goes to different forms of entertainment like music,
yeah,
or others, where it's like, they, you know, there's a popularity to the artist.
Yeah, that's for sure. And I think, you know, the way with the internet, with social media, that's a way that artists can gain followings and popularity. And you know, Murakami is a great example. These new paintings and sculpture that he made for the museum, I didn't even know what these things look like. And I had to follow him on Instagram in order to figure out what it was that I'm going to get in this shipment at the end of the month, you know. So but that's also a really unique part of what he's doing. He's
yeah.
made that totally transparent and
yeah.
opened up the doors to his studio in a way that most artists, I think, are still protecting those
All
trade
right.
secrets.
Let's do this. Let's take a break so we can update on tonight's news. But I really, truly want to talk about that concept, about because there's some videos and there's a lot of media just about his process and the process of putting together his work. Takashi Murakami's new exhibit at the Museum of Contemporary Art is called The Octopus Eats Its Own Leg. In studio with me tonight, Michael Darling, the James W. Alsterf Chief Curator at the MCA, also the curator of this exhibit. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, continue the conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, Michael Darling. He's the chief curator over at the Museum of Contemporary Art. We're talking about Takashi Murakami's new exhibit, The Octopus Eats Its Own Leg, on display till September, right?
Yes, September 24.
We were talking about, you know, thousands of people coming through the museum, a celebrity viral hit, an artist that has had success, and now, I mean, to be able to have new work that is on display at the Museum of Contemporary Art is a huge get for Chicago and for the museum. What's interesting, too, is that he opens the door. We talked about this right before the news. Just he opens the door and is transparent on how he actually does it. And watching some of those videos, I mean, it blew my mind, the idea that he sits at a drawing table and he puts this together. And then there's, you know, he's got 20, 25 assistants with these big slabs on the ground, all responsible for one little part. Like, this is your job to make this circle. This is your job to do this. I mean, it's how unique is that process, or is that something that people working in big scale works, that this is usually how it's done?
Yeah, I think you do. It's quite common these days to have pretty big studios where you have lots of assistants, you know, helping out. And once artists sort of get to a certain stage, you know, maybe they don't have to be the ones to stretch their canvases on their stretcher bars or order the paints and stuff. And so they can start to have people help them with that. But then sometimes the works themselves are so elaborate, or the techniques are so rarefied, that you need these specialists to help execute your
yeah.
vision. So you know, Andy Warhol, for one, had a kind of so-called factory where he had lots of people running around. But nowadays you have somebody like Jeff Koons too, who's famous also for having a really super professionalized studio where all these people are working to produce sculptures.
It's a company,
and paintings.
Right?
Yeah,
right,
it's a company.
Right, right.
And Murakami has slowly developed his studio to become that as well. And the space is gigantic, kind of warehouse on the outskirts of Tokyo. and he has actually hundreds of people that are working for him around the clock. He has a 24/7 kind of schedule over there. And a lot of it is just when you look at the paintings in our show that hopefully people will get a chance to see, you'll realize why, because these are not paintings that they're huge for one, but they're so intricate and complicated that a single person would really only make like one of these every 5 years if they were doing it by themselves.
I mean, let my simpleton brain process this, okay? The artist who comes up with the design and he does the work has a group of assistants, hundreds of people, that are actually doing the painting on the canvas. Is there any question about whether or not it's art? The idea that, you know, I mean, it's a design. No doubt it's a design. But in this case, someone else, a grad student or someone else, is actually putting the stuff on the canvas. And like I said, this is ignorant, you know, my simpleton brain when it comes to contemporary art. But this has changed the concept of what an artist is.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people still hold on to that notion of like the artist alone in their studio with a blank canvas in front of them and then figuring out what they've got to do to make that, to turn that into a piece of art. And I think that has definitely eroded over the years, and it's become quite commonplace for there to be assistants helping you make the work that you do. And especially, again, when it's become so physically impossible for one person to make these kinds of works, you can see the reasoning.
Right.
But in this case, and what we tried to show in those videos is that he's always there. And so he's making the initial drawings. Those go into a computer. The lines get cleaned up. They get spat back out. And then he starts playing with those, adding color, adding patterns. And then eventually these silk screens get burned from these digital files. And then those start to be applied to the canvases. And then he's saying, well, I want that yellow to be orange, or let's move this green. You know, he changes things constantly. So he's working. I mean, he's likened it to being a film director, where he's got all of these different people that have different techniques and specializations that are bringing those expertises
to bear on making
this gigantic production that ends up being a 60 or 100 foot long painting.
Watching it, I was just flabbergasted at the idea that there is one person who is in charge of one silkscreen area. I mean, this is, you're talking about 8 or 9 slabs, really, of these huge canvases across, and the work that you put in, especially the stuff that in the last room at the MCA in this exhibit, you realize, you're like, this is almost the whole wall of this exhibit. And when you see the process, I mean, it's one grad student whose job it is to draw these 4 circles. There's hundreds of circles, but it's this person's job to do these 4. I mean, there really is something about the process and work and labor and art that all kind of circles around into one with this.
Yeah, yeah, it's really true. And that's what I saw when I went to his studio in 2013. I saw these people on their hands and knees on the floor, meticulously swiping on one color after another to build up these surfaces and recognize, like, how do I communicate this to people? Because it seems so fascinating and so intentional and so much craft. It's not about mass production. It's about building up these jewel-like surfaces where, again, you put your nose up near these paintings and your eyes are just completely filled and you're finding details every which way you look. And so they're really unlike anything else that I think is being made anywhere in the world today.
It really is. I mean, I thought about being Cameron and Ferris Bueller when he looks through the painting. But when you're looking at Murakami, you recognize quickly, your eyes adjust to, there's a pattern underneath the pattern that's underneath the design that's, you know, a different color on the, I mean, it's so intricate. And I wonder how many people experience that. Because if you experience it from the center of the room and you look at it, you say, well, that's amazing. The octopus is, this is really great. But when you really get close up and you look at it, you recognize that this is not just one piece, it's 10 pieces, 15, it's 20. Do you encourage people to do, how do people recognize that if they don't recognize it on their own?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the beauty of having an exhibition where these things are, if you're physically present with them. Because if you just saw these on a computer screen, you know, or on your phone, you would never get that level of detail. And so when you get up close, and we try to allow people to get as close as possible without, you know, threatening the paintings. And some of these are very dramatically lit too. So I think you're really encouraged to kind of go up close and look at these things. That's where the payoff is. And so hopefully people are doing that. I've been trying to observe how people are walking through the galleries. Mm-hmm. And I think I see that happening. But But yeah, that's the joy of a true museum exhibition where you finally get to see these things in the flesh. And for a lot of people, that hasn't, it's never been the case in Chicago. There's never been a Murakami show, and it's been 10 years since he has had a big museum show in the United States. So this is people's, in some cases,
when you
first
have
chance.
When you have a successful show like this on the heels of a successful show with David Bowie is. Does it change the way that you approach curation? I mean, as the chief curator there, do you say, now we got to bring thousands of people through the doors? I can't take a risk on this one. I don't know. It's got to be the big dogs from here on out.
Well, I think that's the beauty of how we kind of plan out our year. Well, if we do a show like this that's super accessible where we think we can kind of really get a lot of visitors, it allows us to take some risks on lesser known people and maybe at less highly trafficked times of the year. And mm-hmm. so we're able to kind of balance that out and keep a wide variety in our programming. But me personally, I mean, I just get so excited to see this many people in the museum having a good time. When they were leaving the David Bowie show, they were crying. They were so moved. They were spending 3 hours in there. And like for a curator or a museum, like that is the holy grail. So if we can keep finding shows like this, like Murakami, that allow people to just get excited, to learn something, to come with their friends and their family. I mean, that's something that we want to do.
I mean, as a curator, and you've been doing this job for 7 years, to have something like David Bowie is, and also some of the other stuff, but also the Murakami, do you find yourself chasing that feeling, chasing
yeah.
that emotion where you're like, what's next? I mean, we want Chance the Rapper to come back in here. Like,
yeah.
I mean, you start thinking that way?
For sure. I mean, people after Bowie said, well, what's next? And Murakami kind of was the next, even though in between some of the other summer shows we've
stuff,
had,
yeah.
like Kerry James Marshall last summer,
yeah,
was amazing.
Yeah.
Before that, there was a show called The Freedom Principle, which was all about kind of jazz and improvisation and collectivity. And that also had all these kind of other angles to it. So we're trying to do those kinds of shows. Next summer, we're doing a show called I Was Raised on the Internet. That's all about kind of artists that are making work after all of us, you know, have become so dependent on the internet, that I think is going to be great. And then in 2019, doing a show with the fashion designer and Chicago native Virgil Abloh, which I also am really hoping is going to have that kind of crossover appeal.
We're trying
to invent a new model here.
I think in 2017, we're seeing a new way for museums like the MCA to travel. I mean, this idea that you have found a way to merge this viral culture, the way that people experience things online or just in our lives. Everything needs to, you know, there's this rush to find the next big thing. And to have an art exhibit be that, there's something really great about it. There's something that seems unintentional, but at the same time, extremely intentional.
Yeah, it's true. But again, the trick is that there are not that many of these. These are like unicorns right. to find artists or subject matter that, again, has absolute integrity in terms of history, in terms of culture, but then also have some kind of a popular
right.
hook.
Because you're going to run the risk of artists who may be popular or don't have experience that a Murakami has or the depth. You know, someone says, I'm an artist now, and you're like, well, they're popular artists in whatever other field they're in, so let's just put that up. You run the risk of that.
Yeah,
of,
watering yeah, down right. kind of our own reputation,
yeah.
and we want to be rigorous, and we want to uphold certain standards of art that we think is really great and really matters and is really relevant. So, yeah, we don't want to come across as lightweights here. We want to still keep showing the best art that's being made around the world. So
well, the MCA is definitely a heavyweight. Congratulations on The Octopus Eats Its Own Leg, the Takashi Murakami exhibit, which is on display at the MCA through September 24th. Michael Darling is a James W. Alsdorf chief curator at the MCA, a position he's had since 2010. Michael, thanks for coming in and sharing stories about Murakami, but also the MCA. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks so much.
I mean, more vendors than the Taste of Chicago, wouldn't it? And 500 at Eyes in the Sky. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, we're going to talk about the Warrior Games, which are coming to Chicago this week. I'm really excited to talk with our next guest. Darian Page Rakestraw is now working for Lyft, and Lyft is one of the sponsors for the Warrior Games. But she was at one time served a tour in the Army and in Iraq, but she also served in the White House. She had done a lot of jobs in the White House. I was looking back. She did a New York Times article about her being the White House receptionist at one point. But her big job was she served in the Obama administration as the White House Director of Veterans, Wounded Warriors, and Military Families Outreach. So we'll talk with her. She's got a vantage point about why the Warrior Games are important, what it means that they're coming to Chicago. So much so she convinced her company, Lyft, to fit the bill. So we'll talk with her about what we should be paying attention to. You know, because Warrior Games is a tremendous, tremendous organization. I mean, the games themselves are usually played near military bases or even Paralympic sites. But the idea being that they're closer to military. This is the first time that it's sort of taking over a city, a downtown Chicago. So that'll be starting Friday. And I think John Stewart's the MC, opening night ceremonies. Blake Shelton's going to perform as well. So it's a big deal. It's going to be a Soldier Field, McCormick Place, other places along the lakefront and all around Chicago for the next week to July 8th. So we'll talk with Darian coming up here on The Download. Also tonight, Odd Couple, the hip-hop producer who is pretty much, he has produced pretty much every up-and-coming hip-hop artist that Chicago and the country is talking about. From Chance the Rapper, he worked with Vic Mensa. He's done a ton of stuff with the Closed Session guys who we've had on. And he is organized, and he's going to be participating in a show at Summerfest, which starts here in Milwaukee. So Odd Couple in studio tonight. We'll talk about his philosophy of what a producer does, what a hip-hop producer does. Put the beats together, arrange the music, get the lyricists, the MCs to get out of their comfort zone. So we'll talk about that as well. That's coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Odd Couple on the show. And then 10 o'clock, of course, Greg Flamm will be here. We'll do Swap Meet. And like I said, every 10 minutes or so, that's kind of the strategy tonight. But every 10 minutes or so, Rob Martyr updates us on the weather. You know, we had a couple of tornado warnings and tornado watches, and they continue to be a tornado watch for some areas in the northern suburbs here in the state of Illinois. But right now, it's mostly severe weather warnings, severe thunderstorm warnings. So thunderstorms are barreling through some of the areas like Elgin, just hit Rockford, and seems to be heading, of course, east. No word if it's going to, I mean, because now the warnings come for Cook County. But the question will be how far this line of storms fall south. I don't know if it will hit the city and obviously the southern parts of suburbs in the state. So I think this is a northern storm that seems to be moving east towards Highland Park, Mount Prospect, and some other areas. It seems to be right along 90. If you're driving right now, that's be careful. It's a lot of severe weather coming through. The area, the expressway up there. So pay attention to that. Thanks, Rob. Like we said, we'll pay attention to the severe weather that's hitting the northern part of the state, southern part of Wisconsin right now. About 10 minutes, we'll give you another update. Also coming up a little bit later in the hour, hip-hop producer Odd Couple. He is going to be performing at Summerfest. Big show at Summerfest in Milwaukee coming up on the 4th of July. Odd Couple, I mean, really has been a producer. He's produced everything from Chance to Vic Mensa to the Closed Session guys. I mean, anyone in hip-hop that's coming up in this great Chicago scene, Odd Couple has worked with. So we'll talk about his philosophy coming up after 9:30. Well, this Friday, the Warrior Games will take over Chicago. More than 250 athletes will compete in the annual Department of Defense Warrior Games. The competition is a Paralympic-style competition featuring veterans who have been seriously wounded, ill, or injured. The athletes will take part in events at Soldier Field, the United Center, and other places around town through July 8th. The games have been in existence in 2010, but this is the first time that they have been away from a military base. And this is really an opportunity to tell the stories of these veterans/athletes who represent a reality that many around the country who aren't connected to the military rarely see. To bring the Warrior Games to Chicago, it's always important to gather the resources for something such a grand scale, and that's where my next guest comes in. Darian Page Rakestraw helped convince her employer, the rideshare company Lyft, to be a sponsor. For Darian, she knows the stories of veterans well. She served in the Obama administration as the White House Director of Veterans, Wounded Warriors, and Military Families Outreach. And she knows the military firsthand. She was an Army sergeant who served in Iraq. Chicago and Darian Page Rakestraw, welcome to The Download. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, I mean, this is, I mean, I guess let's start right at the top. What was it that made you go to your employer, to Lyft and say, we got to be involved in the Warrior Games?
Well, you know, being involved with the military and with the veterans community is something that's incredibly passionate for me. I am a third generation veteran. My mother actually served, and she swore my sister and I in. And then amongst my brothers and sisters, four of us are either Iraq or Afghanistan war veterans. So it's always been close. It's my community. It's my peers. It's been my family. So coming into a technology company, it's kind of been my mission to find our way through the veteran space and bring more of a highlight to what veterans go through and the skills that they bring to the table and their strengths and just what it is to serve in the military. We know that, you know, 1% of our country serves. So it's incumbent on the rest of the country to really gather around them, to support them, and to thank them for their service and sacrifice.
You know, as you live in Chicago, I mean, knowing that the Warrior Games are coming here, I mean, what's it mean to you as a veteran, as someone who knows the Warrior Games? Does it mean that they would step away from the military base and some of the play? I mean, I think it was in the South last year and other places. What's it mean for Chicago to get the Warrior Games?
Well, I think it's for the Warrior Games and for Department of Defense is some thinking outside of the box. This is a great way to create exposure for these injured service members and what they go through on a daily basis and the strength of their and the resolve and their character and their ability to continue to compete and continue to give back. They'll be traveling with their families. And we also know that, you know, it's not just a service member. It's a family that really goes through the entire military career and supporting their service member. So for the Department of Defense, I think it's really innovative and awesome. But for the city of Chicago, to be able to experience this and to hear the stories and to see the athletes and their families, what an incredible opportunity. And they're doing it at these amazing venues like Soldier Field and the United Center. So it really highlights how important it is to the city. And so great on, you know, the city and the mayor and Victor Lagrune, who is the director of Veterans Affairs for the city, for them to have made this bid and really pushed hard and done all of the fundraising and coordinating around that.
Well, let's talk about your story, but I really want to talk about your time as the White House Director of Veterans, Wounded Warriors, and Military Families Outreach. You know, I think about that job. And what we know as wounded warriors come home, and like you just mentioned about how important it is to include families as well because of the support. When you took that job, when you had that job in the White House, was it surprising to you that of just the volume of people that needed to be connected, that the families and the wounded warriors needed support?
You know, I don't think that it's surprising. I think that President Obama really understood the responsibility of being commander-in-chief and what it meant to have all of these lives in his hands and all of these families to be responsible for them. I think with regard to the vice president and his son's service and Dr. Biden and the first lady and their interest and engagement in military families and making sure that that support was there, it doesn't surprise me at all that this is something that the administration really wanted to focus on. It was an incredible opportunity for me as a young staffer, knowing that this was something that I was passionate about.
What did you have to do? What was the job?
Well, so on any given day, it really was just a range of issues from working with Gold Star families to make sure that they were getting the support given their just ultimate sacrifice, to working with wounded warriors in the military hospital to ensure that the president was available to those wounded warriors. He really made a commitment that he would be there for them. And then working with the veteran service organizations and being their direct liaison. As a liaison in the Office of Public Engagement, I was the front door for the military community to the Obama administration.
You know, for you to be to have served as well, to be in the Army, as you think about having that job where you have to the outreach to families to make sure that wounded soldiers are taken care of, but also to deal with, making sure the families of soldiers that died in the line of duty are taken care of. What does that mean to you as someone who had served to have that responsibility in the White House?
I mean, what an incredible honor. Yeah, I was just humbled every single day by the strength of these families, by their ability to continue to support each other and support their children in the midst of, you know, really unbelievable situations. I had one spouse, her husband had deployed 6 times. And you think about, that's a year every single time, and how hard that had to be. And she never gave up, and she was always there for him. And you think about those stories, and you're just blown away by how strong they are. And you think about the children who are involved and how resilient they are. They move every 2 to 4 years, and they go for, you know, 6 months to a year without their parents. How hard that has to be, but their ability to overcome and be incredible was really overwhelming.
Darian, as someone who comes from a military family, as you mentioned at the top, does that give you insight? Does it give you experience or understanding in dealing with other military families who you had to deal with in the White House?
Definitely. I mean, I think that my experience made me relevant to these families. They knew that I had been in their shoes from being a child whose mom, my mom deployed to the Gulf War 6 weeks after she had my little sister. So she left my dad with 6 kids under the age of 11. And I remember waiting for her to come home. So I've been there, and I've also been on the other side of it, where my unit was one of the first units to deploy to for the invasion of Iraq. So I knew that experience as well. And so for these military families, it was really relatable, I think, to have that experience and to have somebody who uniquely understood their set of circumstances.
Darian Page Rakestraw is in studio with me. She is the former White House Director of Veterans, Wounded Warriors, and Military Families Outreach. She also is with her company, the rideshare company Lyft. She convinced the employer to be a part of the team that's sponsoring the Warrior Games, which are in town starting on Friday through July 8th. There's going to be a competition, Paralympic-style competition, all over Chicago, from Soldier Field to the United Center to McCormick Place, like I said, running through July 8th. What we'll do right now, we'll take a break, and we'll get an update from Rob on some severe weather. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation here on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. My guest, Darian Page Rakestraw. She's the former White House Director of Veterans, Wounded Warriors, and Military Families Outreach. Also, employee of Lyft, the rideshare company, who are sponsoring the Warrior Games, which will be in town starting on Friday through July 8th here in Chicago at Soldier Field, United Center, other places around. You know, it's interesting because when you put the idea of politics, we see this even with the Trump administration, we saw with the Obama administration, and veterans, you usually get a mix of, I guess, just how the Department of Veterans Affairs and others are not living up to their promise. You get essentially the government letting down soldiers, letting down anyone who served the military. From your vantage point as someone who has served in the military and also served in the government, do you see that? Do you understand when things like those kind of stories come up and the controversies swirl around care for veterans?
You know, I really do. I think that at the end of the day, as a country, we can always do more. There is a service and a sacrifice that these service members have given that can never be repaid, and we owe them a tremendous a level of gratitude, and there's a debt that really cannot be repaid. And so I think that when you look at those situations, I really believe, I have to believe that everyone is doing their best, that regardless of which administration you're part of, which side, that service members and veterans are a nonpartisan issue. We all have to support them. We all have to come together and say thank you for your service and sacrifice and do what we can. So in my heart of hearts, I have to believe that that's what's going on.
Well, I mean, for you, let's put aside your government service, talk about your military service. Mm-hmm. As a sergeant who served in Iraq, do you feel like coming back and being done with your tour and having the opportunity to go to school and integrate back into society, when you just put on that hat, do you think that the United States has done a good job of supporting you?
I do. I feel like I have had so many opportunities and so many great mentors, both military and on the civilian side, who have taught me about the private sector and what government life looks like and how to be a good student and then how to be a good leader. I've been really fortunate, and I feel very blessed to have had the opportunities that I've had, but also to help others along the way. And I think that that is a lot of what I feel like my core values are, is, you know, focusing on community and strong values in that way of giving back to the people who I've served with and other people who have served, to make sure that there are greater opportunities, not just economically, but it just in experiences.
Right. You know, as you mentioned earlier in the interview, just the idea of being one of the first deployed for the invasion of Iraq. Well, I mean, take us to that moment, the idea of being in that space and being the first deployed. I mean, for you as a young soldier at that point, I mean, what's going through your mind as you get ready to invade another country?
Wow. I talked to my mom before I left, and her words of advice were, keep your head down. And that's really what my focus was, just trying to do the best job. We were going into a space that we didn't know anything about. I ended up flying directly into Baghdad, and just being in that plane on that first trip in was mind-blowing and overwhelming and really, really just out of this world to think that this is what was about to happen. But as a soldier, you train for the mission. This is what you are prepared to do. And I think, you know, this is why they call us the greatest fighting force in the world. We are well trained and well equipped and prepared to take on any mission. And I think that that idea has really prepared me for all of the experiences I've had since then, from going to school and being in a new city. Chicago is the first city I've ever chosen to live in my life. And then going from, you know, a school to the Obama administration. And I got 3 days notice that I was going to D.C. and I needed to pack up my entire life. And even from there, going into this experience and working in a technology company is completely new to me. But again, I think it goes back to values, and Lyft ended up being a really good fit for me because it is so community-based and driven in values that are important to me and close to my heart.
You know, I mean, your resume, I mean, we could do 2 hours on the different jobs that we could. I mean, it's amazing to think about all things that you have been able to accomplish in your young life. You know, as you think about soldiers, especially in modern warfare, I mean, a lot of what we see, is, and I'm sure that you've dealt with at the White House in the role that you played, and even with the weekend war or the Warrior Games that are coming up this weekend, you know, PTSD plays a big part in just being in combat. We're seeing this, I mean, a soldier can come back unscathed in a way that they don't show physical ailments but have mental ailments forever. I mean, you think about that stuff as someone who not only served in battle, but has been in a point where you have to do outreach to families and to soldiers who may have PTSD.
100%. This is an experience that stays with you for the rest of your life, and it doesn't just affect you. It affects your family and your friends and your children and, you know, the people who employ you. And there, for a very long time, I feel like was a stigma around that. But I think that the more people learn about the resilience and the strength and the skills that service members and veterans bring to the table, the less that stigma has really affected this 9/11 generation. But I think that this is also the first generation that has been willing to talk about it and been open to seeking alternative forms of treatment and, you know, expressing, this is what's going on. I'm going to tell my story and I'm going to be open about this so that other people are willing to talk about it. People shouldn't suffer in silence. And they are suffering because of an experience that they had by serving their country. And so in turn, this country owes it to them to make sure that when they come back, that they get holistic care.
All right, let's talk Warrior Games as we wrap up here. All right, so what are you looking forward to as someone who has not only, you know, put the company's money up to sponsor this, but as a former soldier and someone who's worked in outreach for wounded warriors? What are you looking forward to? What is your recommendation for the weekend and for the next week?
Well, I'm excited about a couple of things. The first one being, you know, this is a cross-national event. So the UK forces are coming in, the Australian forces are coming in to compete. The Special Operations Command has their own team. So there are going to be so many people from diverse backgrounds here, and they'll be competing in games from wheelchair basketball to archery and track and field. Really excited about that. Really excited about the opening concert. It's Blake Shelton and Kelly Clarkson and Jon Stewart is hosting. But, I mean, from a personal perspective, one of the cool things about working for a technology company and a ride-sharing company like Lyft that is kind of, you know, really innovative in what they're doing, we have actually created a new mode as part of our app. So when you open up the app, there will be the traditional modes from Lyft Lux to
right, like regular
Premier
car, right,
Plus,
right.
Exactly, but there will be a warrior mode, and we're going to have military-grade Humvees up on the platform. And so people will be able to travel to and from the Warrior Games in a Humvee.
Is it just for the Warrior Games? You can let them do it anywhere.
No. Oh, no. I don't
just
know
the Warrior Games, right?
Just for the Warrior Games. Exactly.
Because I could just assume, you know, the West Loop and Randolph is just going to be
seeing a Humvee over, rolling Humvees, down Michigan Ave is going to be one of the highlights for me.
Well, we're looking forward to it. Darian Page Rakestraw is the former White House Director of Veterans, Wounded Warriors, and Military Families Outreach. She's also a part of the rideshare company Lyft, who's sponsoring the Warrior Games, which take place this week, starting on Friday, and they go through July 8th all over Chicago, Soldier Field, the United Center, McCormick Place, and others. Darian, thanks so much. Great to meet you, and congratulations on getting the Warrior Games to Chicago, and we appreciate you coming in tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is a Chicago hip-hop producer, Odd Couple, also known as Zach Henderson, has been working in town since he came to DePaul back in 2007. And truly, he has been instrumental in the Chicago rap renaissance, working with and producing tracks for Chance, Joey Perp, Jamila Woods, Mick Jenkins, No Name, Kwaku Collins, Taylor Bennett, Saba. I don't know why I name every single rapper in town, because Odd Couple has worked with them. He's producing new music constantly. His latest album came out last year. It was called Liberation. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, etc. He's partnered with Summerfest this year in Milwaukee to create Lakeside Forecast, a festival that's going to feature some of the great artists mentioned above, both from Chicago and Milwaukee. That's happening on the 4th of July up at the Summerfest grounds, and Odd Couple is my guest tonight. Odd Couple, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Hey, man. Thank you guys for having me.
It's really fun today listening to the music that you produce and recognizing a lot of the artists that have been on the show. I've listened to this music already.
Yeah.
Talk about just the idea of producing in the Chicago rap scene. Right now, couldn't be hotter right now for all the rappers coming out.
It's
What's
crazy.
It mean to you to be a guy who's involved with that?
It means so much to me because, like, I'm a guy of, like, I'm really sentimental. You know what I mean? Like, home is where the heart is, all that. Like, that's me 100%. So it's really cool to work in an environment like this and help attribute to, like, the renaissance of, like, Chicago. It's not even just rap. It's, you know, general all-around music scene. The intrigue is so high, different genres. I'm blessed to be able to work in all these different genres with these stars, but I'm such a sentimental guy. Being able to work with, like, these people that I met in 2009. I met Chance when he was, like, graduating high school. Like, I met him during the 10-day days. Like, you know what I mean? During the 10-day suspension, we were chilling over at Pat's house working on stuff. You know what I mean? Like, I met him during that. So I think I was at Vic's, like, 18th birthday party. Just, like, popped through randomly. You know what I mean? Like, I'm a junior in college. These kids are just, like, I'm hearing what they're doing, and I'm seeing what they're working on, and I'm working on my music at the same time. But it means something really special to be able to help build this from the start and not even be strong in it myself, and then have the scene explode and then look at my own career and be like, man, I can directly attribute, like, my success to the scene growing, but I could also look at it the other way and be like, man, I could attribute the scene growing to my growth of my sound.
Take us back to 2009, even before that at DePaul. I mean, what were you thinking about? I mean, what was the music scene like here in Chicago? And talk about, you know, how you got involved in this.
Man, I mean, anybody making beats my age, right? You grew up on Kanye. Like, you know what I mean? You grew up listening to Kanye West. You grew up listening to that. But for me, it wasn't like Ye was the height of the Chicago sound, but he wasn't just the only one making sound at the time. You know what I mean? It was like Lupe, Common, Rhymefest, GLC, the whole all those guys, like those are the guys I was listening to.
So
like,
you're listening to local guys.
Yeah, man. I was always into Chicago sound. I just being from Milwaukee, there's so many parallels, man. There's so many the everyday fight that it is just to live in Chicago. You know what I mean? Like, you got to have an attitude, but you also got to have a heart, because it's like one day you're going to be walking and you're going to see someone who needs your help, but also the next time you're going to see someone trying to take advantage of you. That's like, that's how it is in Chicago. You got to develop that thick skin or whatever. And Milwaukee's very similar way. Mm-hmm. Like, you develop this sense of hometown pride. No one's taking this from us, but at the same time, you're like, but I'm going to make it out. You know what I mean?
Like, what was the sound like? I mean, when I think of Kanye West and Common and some of the artists that you talked about, they are a representative of the conscious rap,
exactly.
The backpack rap, even if you think of Common and Kanye.
Right.
Was that the kind of sound that you were into? I mean, what was the sound that you liked?
I've always been, man, I love production. All types of production. Anything that has a good instrumentation to it, like, it's my type of thing. A lot of my friends grew up, like, loving rappers, right? I grew up loving producers. I grew up like, oh, Timbaland made this beat? Yeah, you get an extra 30 seconds listen. You know what I mean? Even if I never heard of this. Like, who is Magoo? I don't know. But it's Timbaland and Magoo, so I'll listen to the song. You know what I mean? I was like that. So I just dove into anything he produced. Anything Neptune's produced, anything Kanye, of course, like anything Just Blaze produced, like just those are like my four. Those are like my Mount Rushmore. That's what allows me to like make music.
How do those artists and their impact on you as a young producer, how does it feel today? I mean, when I hear your music now, Odd Couple, right. What can you draw back to being a fan of those artists from years back?
Man, with take it piece by piece, man, with the Neptunes, it was the ability to use weird sounds and make them cool. You know what I mean? The same thing with Timbaland. Like, there was just their unorthodox methods of using anything. Like, one of the most popular Timbaland-produced songs is Aaliyah, If You Are Somebody. And he samples her laughing as a baby in the song. Like, he uses a clip of her laughing as a baby and samples that in the record, right? That's crazy. Like, who's doing that? Nobody's doing that. There's clips grinding by Neptunes, like, you know, they sample them like hitting the side of their mouth, and they use that in the record, like weird sounds like that. I mean, I use different types of interesting sounds, and I try to sample weird stuff, sample myself, and use like sounds that aren't, you know, instead of using a regular clap, like maybe I'll use like a bottle squeezing, mm-hmm. like maybe I'll like use like a somebody throwing a bottle in an alley and use that instead of a clap. Like, just a cool sound like that. You listen to, like, Kanye, it's the arrangement, the orchestration of things, the way you can bring together classical elements in an instrumental or in a track. You know, you listen to College Dropout. It was so cool. The storytelling, the vibe, all that was just amazing. You never heard a rapper be so honest. But what really did it was the fact that, like, this dude's got gospel choir on
the
track.
Production's so great.
You know what I mean? It's so the production. Yeah. It's like it's fluid. Everything flows together. And like that's something I always pay super close attention to. So some of my more famous or bigger Odd Couple joints, like off of Liberation especially, the arrangement is something I paid really close attention to because I grew up on that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Listening to Liberation and listening to it all day, I mean, it is a varied and a stylistically arranged album in the idea that it's not just rap songs. I mean, there's stuff that's going to break down, and even some of the newer stuff that you're doing, you're experimenting in almost just a song, you know, like an orchestral song. It has nothing to do with hip hop. Talk about how diverse you want your sound to be when you're producing beats and producing music.
Man, I never want to be held in a box. And I think in life, that's one thing that I struggle with so much. Not even struggle with. I mean, it's not hard. It's me. I just refuse to be put in a box. I mean, I'm 6'6", man. What box you got? Like, but for real, it's like, you're a black man in America. You grow up, you already don't want to be in a box, right? You already feel like you're in a box. So that right there is like the plight alone is just getting outside of that. But for me, it's in life, you know, I work, I make music. I'm a family man. I hang out with my friends. You catch me on Friday night at the club. You catch me Sunday morning at church. Like I refuse to be one thing, you know, and my music has gotten more and more personal as I gotten older. I don't know if it's on purpose or if it's just how it happens. It's how it happens with everybody. But I don't know. I feel so like in tune with what I want as a man. It's really starting to shine through in the music. I refuse to be put in a box. I want to have a string section on this or a gospel choir on this or song with no words that you could swore there was words to. You know what I mean? Like,
right,
I do
right.
what I can.
You've made your name in collaborating with rappers.
Right.
And you know, in some of the most recent work, Liberation, but also being the executive producer on Jamila Woods' record, Heaven, you get the sense that you're moving beyond that, that
right.
it's not just about matching beats to rap or to hip-hop artists, but you're really trying to stretch and try different things.
Yeah, exactly, man. I'm really trying to see what the full potential of what I can do is. And I think that once you start to only see things from one perspective, hear things one way, you hear an instantly, you hear a backdrop as a producer, you know, you want to lay drums on it. Laying that establishes one way that the song can come at it. The way I start to create songs now is I start to create the backdrop as much as possible so that whatever is going with that, whether it be a drum, whether it be somebody's voice, whether that be more instruments, each piece has its own place to live. I stopped looking at things as like a puzzle that's already has a pre-constructed ending and I need to find the pieces to make that puzzle. I started looking at things as puzzle pieces on
yeah,
the table
right.
and then make the most perfect puzzle out of those pieces that I could. And that's what I really started to do now. And I love rap. Grew up on that, man. Like, if I go back in time and be anything, I'd be a rapper because it's like, it's so dope. You know what I mean? And like, you can rap really good and make good enough beats and like, you'll be amazing.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? So, you know, that's just me kind of joking around. But for real, it's rap is such it's a very like fluid genre right now. There's so many different aspects of it. It's hard to even say what is rap, what is not in a lot of sense. You
yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah.
I love the fact that the genres are melding so much at this point that you can't really put things in a box. So it was only natural for me as like to start off as a rap head to move into other genres. It's the way I've always seen it done by the guys we talked about earlier. I didn't just study their sound. I studied their careers, studied what they did right, studied their mistakes. Like, try to, you know what I mean? Like, I'm sure I'm going to repeat them, and I'm sure I'm about to mess some stuff up on my
That's
own.
That's part of it, though.
You know
just
I mean?
Got to recognize it, right?
Right? You know what I mean? You know you're going to screw it up. It is what it is. But it's like also being able to see that they were able to transcend genres. That's also what I love so much about it. The fact that I could listen to a Pharrell record that is, you know, on just, you know, I could listen to Senorita and be like, Neptune's made that beat? And I could listen to Clips and be like, Neptune's made that beat? And I could listen to, like, Future move that dope. Pharrell's on it, rapping on this song. Like, he has no box.
He has no box.
You know what I mean? All the stuff
right.
with Daft Punk, it's like, wow, literally, this dude has no box. Timbaland, decades of music from Genuine to Missy Elliott to Aaliyah to like stuff now to Nelly Furtado tracks to JT songs. You know what I mean? Like, you can't be in a box. You have to be able to move to other genres. You have to be able to bring your sound and help define. When you're a producer and you have a sound, and you're starting to really like experiment with that and realize that, you know, that sound is infectious and people really do like it and are gravitating towards the same thing in it that is what's creating it from your end, you start to realize, like, man, my sound isn't defining a genre, or my sound isn't like all the tracks that are under my name. My sound is helping define an era, right? The best way you can really help define that era is to get out there and be a part of as much as possible, you know? That's one thing.
Yeah.
We've seen Chance grow so much, and he's involved in so much right now. The reason that people are really gravitating towards what he does is because he's not just like, no, I'm not just a rapper. And that's why it's so funny. His name's Chance the Rapper. Like,
yeah.
Man's like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
if you just call him a rapper, like, you know, people will look at you like, you know what I mean? Like,
it's a little
living under a rock,
right.
Man. Like, that's it. That's what you're going to call him. No, he's an entrepreneur. He's damn near a politician. He's doing everything. You know what I mean? Like, he's got it all covered. So it's not to say that I'm trying to do any of that, but it's
right.
just to say that, like, you have something that you think the world is gravitating towards. You feel that something is there and it's bigger than you. And it's for more people than just you. Like, you need to find your way to spread that as much as possible.
Chicago producer Odd Couple in studio. He's going to be at Summerfest coming up here on the 4th of July up in Milwaukee. We'll continue the conversation. Stay with us. A little something off Liberation, the album by Odd Couple. That's Jamila Woods right there. Odd Couple in studio, the hip-hop producer who will be performing at the first Lakeside Forecast. It's at Summerfest. It's on the 4th of July at the Briggs and Stratton Stage, in Milwaukee. Performances by Odd Couple, Webster X, Jamila Woods, Saba, Joey Purr, pretty much everybody's been on the show. That's coming up on the 4th of July this year. You know, as I think about the music, when you're collaborating with musicians and you have artists, rappers that come in the studio and you want to get a certain sound out of them, how do you sort of push them to get out of a comfort zone to collaborate with you?
Collaborating with other artists, at first I used to find it as intimidating or like, this is game time, like show up. And then after a while you sort of realize like, man, these are people too that are going through the same insecurities you go through in life, the same trials, tribulations. They're just like you, except in some cases they have on cooler clothes. Like, you know what I mean? Like, but like, that's it. I said some cases, mind
some cases.
You.
Come on. Yeah.
When you're sharing that space, on my end, what I always want to do is I want to talk about life. I want to talk about what you're going through, what I'm going through. I want to tell stories. I want to get to know you and get to know what makes you tick. I think like one thing as a producer that really like works in my favor is I have like kind of ability to kind of see through a lot. Like, you know, you meet someone and they give you that first impression. I'm like, always try to see past that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? No matter what it is, if you're super nice when I meet you, I'm not assuming you're not. I'm just saying like, what else is there to you? There has to be more.
You have to find that.
Exactly.
Because you're creating art together.
And as I said, man, to me, my art has gotten so much more personal as I've gotten older. So now I want to talk to you about life. I mean, I know, like, I'm confident in my abilities. I know we're going to leave with something that I'll be nodding my head to. But what I want to do is talk with you and figure out what you're going through, figure out where you're at, where your headspace is at. I can talk all day. You know what I mean? So let's just have a conversation.
You don't hear that necessarily when it comes to hip-hop or rap where there's the artists are trying to push to a deeper meaning.
Right.
Where they're trying to talk about things that are happening in their lives or their shared experiences. And if you really, really, truly listen to some of the Chicago stuff, your stuff and others that are coming out, that's all it is.
Yeah.
So talk about that idea of what, you know, I guess what's fed to the top 40 audience. It's just about girls and money. But everything else that people seem to be gravitating that's winning on the internet is really talking about real life.
The boundary between quote unquote artist and fan is like broken down right now. It's people. People are gravitating towards other people. The more I start to let the veil down in my life and just be real with whoever's following, whoever's trying to listen to my music, when I made an album like Liberation, which is just based off my own growing as a person, coming to man and realizing different things in my life that I don't need to do or need to be a part of or need to even like devote energy to, mental energy to, memories to, anything like that, I found freedom in that, right? Mm-hmm. I made an album called Liberation about that freedom. I haven't been so happy my entire life than putting that out, not just feeling that freedom, but people being like, yeah, that's amazing. Like, I need that. You know what I mean? I'm sharing my story. People are gravitating more towards, you know, Zach than they are gravitating towards this mythical one guy with two guy name. You know what I mean? Like, they're gravitating towards that a lot more. So it's the same time. People are really gravitating towards the personal story in it because they want to meet the person. These days, they don't necessarily think, oh, the brand of insert the blank, you know, the brand of Anderson .Paak is cool. They think, oh, that's a cool guy.
Yeah, right.
Like what's so personal.
Personality drives.
Yeah, what's so cool about Kendrick Lamar is it's like, oh, this is a guy talking about the different paradoxes and parallels in his life and how he can connect to that. Like the reason we love guys like Tupac and Biggie is they tell us what was going on.
So let me ask you this. I mean, as you know, most of the people you just mentioned are all lyricists. They're all people who are out front. They're the head rappers. I mean, as a producer who wants to explore the same territory, that wants to create an art that talks about real life issues and how, talk about what you can do as a producer to do that, especially since, and not really, but in a way, sort of in the backseat.
Right. And the word producer has taken on a whole much more leading man, leading role type of connotation in the past few years, right? Like, used to be the producer was like, oh, okay, let me find out who made the beat.
Right.
But I still, like, the rapper is the guy I'm going to go look at to find, like, the songs I want to listen to. You know what I mean? Now, the way I used to look at producers, oh, Timbaland made this, I'll listen to it. Right. It's that way again now. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, this is a Diplo song. I don't care who's singing the top line. I just want to hear Diplo beats. You know what I mean?
Like, but it's hard. I mean, it's yeah. music. It's going to make you feel a certain way. But it doesn't have that Kendrick Lamar specialness where he can totally explain something in poetic way about racism or about anything that's happening around him. And you're like, that's brilliant. How do you do that as a producer?
Man, I try to set a tone. I try to set a bring you into my world, which is much more than what lyricist or something like that. A lot of times is what you hear, a beat, a backdrop, an instrumental, like they can bring upon other type of memories that sometimes words can't. Like words are very literal. You take words for what you hear. You know what I mean? Unless it's double entendre. I mean, even then it's two meanings. Pick one.
Pick
you
one.
Know what I mean? Like you have 50-50 chance there. This isn't a multiple choice test when you're a producer. I'm giving you like an essay test. I want to see what you take away from this vibe that I'm setting. So when you hear a song come in and the first 8 seconds got you, generally that's not going to be because somebody's yelling at you. It's going to be because like, oh man, those piano chords remind me of like church.
There's a feel to it.
Yeah, and then that trumpet, like, oh man, like that sounds like that's heavenly. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, those are a beat can give you a lot more adjectives, a lot more memories, a lot more, bring upon a lot more emotion easier. And it's much more subjective in the best possible way. With lyrics, the subjectiveness is like, subjectivity rather, is like, oh, who's the best? What's the dopest?
Yeah.
Who's rapping better? Who's rapping faster? With a instrumental, it's like, oh man, like this might be technically better, but like this makes me happy. You know what I mean? Or this one is like, this is a perfect song for when I'm feeling like this. Or this is a perfect song when I'm feeling like that. As a producer, I try to really see the big picture in terms of how people are going to interpret the music. Like, how is it going to make them feel over time? How is this song going to be able to replay it? How is this song going to be able to like really get across what I was feeling and what I was, the emotions that it brought up out of me when I was starting to lay the backdrop, you know?
Chicago music producer Odd Couple in studio tonight. He has partnered with Summerfest in Milwaukee to create the Lakeside Forecast, which is a festival that's going to feature some great artists, artists you've worked with both in Chicago and Milwaukee. That's happening on the 4th of July at the Summerfest grounds in Milwaukee. Odd Couple, his album Liberation is on all the streaming sites. He continues to do great work here in Chicago. My pleasure to have you here. Thanks for being here. Appreciate
it. Thank you guys so much. Life dream right here. Awesome.
Yeah, you can call me Joey Purple Potion. I'm 20, I was chosen.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure. Like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Or it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam.
Here I am.
That's right. It's a Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. This is our Wednesday night segment where we evaluate your memorabilia, your collectibles, your junk. Just had to get that in the right order.
Right.
Greg Flam at DuPage Picker on Facebook and Twitter, ready to tell you what your junk is worth. Greg, good to see you, buddy.
Good to see you. Thanks, Justin.
All right, we already got some people texting in and calling. 312-981-7200. All right, so before we get into sort of evaluating everybody's, having people brag about their junk, let's brag about yours. What do you got this week?
Well, I brought in the WGN commemorative Blues Brother poster.
Oh, this is the best thing ever.
It's 70 seasons. So they used this picture, I guess, earlier for a Blues Brothers promo.
Of course they did.
Yeah, and then they ran it again, and our buddy Tom Thayer on the right.
My favorite on Thayer is they make it seem as if they have, I don't know if they're off, they like grease them up, right?
Yeah, they look
so they all look like they're a little bit like they've played football, and you can see like the makeup grease they put on Thayer's arms to make it seem like he just played football.
Yeah, he looked like he fixed the car more than played football.
Yeah, right? But, look at that.
But yeah, anyways, yeah, so I just decided I'm going to bring in a Bears poster every week because I have so many different ones. I'm just going to bring in one a week.
Look at that poster, guys. You see that?
So yeah, so and then some of the other stuff
Bears.
I brought.
Look at that. You got I can't even move on. This is the best poster I've ever
seen. Is that Hilgenberg 63?
You got Hilgenberg. Mm-hmm. You got a Covert, Jimbo Covert.
Yep.
You got a Thayer, of course. You got what's his name? Van Horn?
Yes.
Keith Van Horn. And who's the fifth guy? Is that a Bortz? Let's see. Who we got in a...
Yep.
Yeah, did I get it?
Yeah, Bortz.
sports.
Yeah.
You got them all.
Yes. Best poster of all time.
That's right.
All right. Like Rob said, $1,500. I'll give you $2,000.
Yeah. I'll take half that.
All right. What else you got?
Well, you know me. I do my anniversary stuff, and we've got 1953, first Corvette came out this week.
Wow. Okay.
So, yeah. So that's what the first one costs, like $3,500. Thought that was
my father-in-law had a, and I couldn't tell you what it was, and he's probably upset with me because he's probably told me 10, 15 times, but he had an old Corvette, probably a 60s, right?
Okay.
That was in the garage for a good 15 years, probably longer in his life, I've known him for 15.
Wow.
And it was always there, and he's always like, I got to fix this one thing, and then it's going to work. And then just like 2 years ago, he sold it.
Wow.
But it was like, it was always there, and I'd always be like, wow, that's a Corvette. Hey, Ken, you want to take us for a ride?
You happen to know how many miles were on it, or no?
No, I know is that it didn't run, and he had to fix this, and he had to fix that.
Right.
He had a Corvette in the garage, and I always thought that was cool.
Yep. And let's see, 1979, first Sony Walkman came out, so I brought a couple different versions of them.
Yeah, there you go.
What you're looking for when you find these, I just sold a broken Sony Walkman from 1983 or 5 or something like that. For $90, broken. Okay,
I would think that everybody would have a Sony Walkman.
Right. So I'm giving you this tip. Look around, and if the model number is usually like WM, WMD dash whatever number, if the number is a single digit, you've got something.
Okay.
So that's our tip for the people. And that's about it. Yeah. And
you know,
the first one cost $150.
The first Sony Walkman?
Yeah, that's quite a bit for $79.
Yeah, right. I feel like I would have had one probably in the mid-80s. That was where I'd be, and it was, I don't want to make a big deal about it, but jamming a Huey Lewis tape.
Yeah, I skipped over the Sony cassette Walkman, but I remember getting a
CD.
Discman.
Yeah.
And I wish I had that, because those are like $200-$300 now.
You get a Huey Lewis, maybe a Whitney Houston.
Right.
A Paul Simon when that record came out.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
So the tape, are those tapes worth any tapes?
The tapes are, yeah. I mean, not
what
those.
What about a Kasingle? The Kasingles
Kasingle,
go?
Yeah.
All right.
Rock. I still collect the Rock Kasingles, anything like Aerosmith, Metallica.
Do those go for anything?
They do.
They're
a few bucks, yeah. And you can get them for like 10 cents at garage sales. And, you bundle them together and sell like $20 worth at a time or something.
I love it.
But that's what I do.
So, all right, 312-981-7200. We got some good stuff. If you got any singles that you want to brag about tonight,
here we go.
This is Swap Meet, sponsored by Wolf's Flea Market. All right, we'll take a quick break, and then I've got Laura on the line. I got Barry on the line. I've got some people that are texting in. 312-981-7200. What do you want to brag about? Or do you have some collectibles or anything that you might own that you want to see what it's worth? Greg Flam is here at DuPage Picker. Stay with us. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's the Swap Meet, sponsored by Wolf's Flea Market. 312-981-7200. Greg Flam at DuPage Picker in studio, as he is every Wednesday, to evaluate your memorabilia, your collectibles, your junk. What do you want to brag about tonight? We got a lot of people on the line, as well as some texts that are coming in. 312-981-7200. Why don't we kick it off tonight with Barry? Barry, what do you want to brag about, Barry?
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Hey,
how about you?
Take my call.
No problem.
Thank you.
In my family, we've had a banner that hung across City Hall back in the 60s when the astronauts Ed White and Gus Grissom came to for a parade.
Hmm. Okay.
Ed White was the first astronaut, first man to walk in space.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Oh, that's cool. Was that City Hall in Chicago?
Yeah.
I love it, man.
That relative that was the foreman of the print shop.
See, this is the kind of stuff that I geek out on. I love this stuff, Barry. All right, what would a banner, a City Hall banner, how big is the banner? Is it like a huge kind of like?
Well, it's about 3 feet high and about 50 feet long.
What? That's all?
Yeah, it's going to be hard to compare that to something, but I'm still guessing it's in the minimum $200 to $300 start.
Get rid of. I'm just curious on if there's a value to it.
Yeah. I don't know if there's probably nothing like it.
Right.
So then you get into a game where you're just trying to figure out who actually values something like that. I do.
Right.
But I would say that, you're onto something that's like an awesome starter, like a great story starter.
Right. And if you do sell it and you happen to do like an online auction, stick with the auction for like two or three times, because it might take a while for the right two people to get in a bidding war with it.
Yeah.
A lot of people give up after that first 5-day or 7-day auction and then just do a buy it
now.
So that's what I'll suggest, because it's such a rare item and there's nothing to compare it to. So I would have patience with the auction process.
I love the Chicago history stuff. Thanks, Barry.
Thank you much.
Thanks for calling.
Have a good night.
That's a great way to start. I love that stuff.
Yep.
Anything old Chicago, I'm into. Yep. Laura, what do you want to brag about, Laura?
We have a lot of collection of old Avon bottles.
Right.
And a lot of them are like when they had the car series.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe like Avon, like makeup.
Avon collectible bottles are the bane of my existence. I am a sucker. I'll buy the car ones or the mini bike. They made hundreds of different ones. I mean, you can get it in the shape of a Duracell battery. You can get it in the shape of a old gasoline pump. I mean, they made hundreds of different designs, as you probably know.
Right.
I buy them and then I want to sell them, and they're really, I'm lucky if I get $3 or $4, and then you got to risk them, you know, cracking open and the whole perfume or aftershave or some cases shampoo leaking, and you can't ship them USPS. But anyway, I digress. But at any rate, like, usually people sell lots of them, and I'm seeing a lot of like 28. The highest is ever sold for 28 of them for $262 for the whole lot.
Ooh, okay.
But generally, they're $3 to $5 each for most of them. So yeah.
Well, that's good to know. A lot of them are, they were never opened and they're in the boxes yet.
Exactly, and that's the only way I would buy them. I never buy the empty ones, because obviously, if you're going to resell them, you want mint.
Laura,
you know.
It sounds like to me you got a couple of them. So what I would do is I'd keep a couple in the package and I pull the other ones out and just see what maybe a new fragrance,
right?
A new smell.
They definitely got that 70s smell. Yep. As she will say. I mean, like I said, so I have to, like, now when I see them, I just got to be like, no, and keep walking, because I'm a sucker for it. I see the Porsche when I want that, or the mini bike when I want that, you know, so I got to stop.
Okay. All right.
But it's a good topic. It's kind of the Beanie Baby thing. There are probably a handful of ones that are worth quite a bit, but the rest are $3 to $5.
I'm intrigued.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Laura.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Yeah, she should just put a little of that underneath the ears.
I had one break in the back of my car and for 2 weeks, and that kind of killed it for me. I'm like, no more.
No more. Let's go to Kay. Kay, what do you got? What do you want to brag about, Kay?
I have an Anakin's pod helmet in the box from Star Wars.
Anakin Skywalker, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Spoiler alert, but did you know that Anakin Skywalker turns into Darth Vader? You knew that? Everyone knew that? Am I the only one who's just, okay. All right, okay. Just figuring that out.
Yeah.
I need some more information. Do you happen to have the manufacturer, like, was it Kenner? Was it what brand, your toy brand?
Oh, golly, it's up in the attic.
Yeah,
you know,
they make so much of that stuff, so it's really hard to get the exact one that you might have.
Yeah.
This is the pod racer scene where he's taking, if he wins, he gets freed. If not, he's got to go back into child slavery, you know, because Star Wars was so...
Yeah,
such a uproarious, joyful story about child slavery.
Do you is it still in the package, or what kind of condition is it? Okay,
it's never been used, never been played with, and
what year would you say it is?
I can't tell you that either. Now I'm
that's okay.
Early 2000s, man. Right.
Right. Yeah.
That's when it came out. Like, it came out, like, didn't that movie come in right around 2000?
Yeah. And you know, I am not.
It says on the box.
Okay.
She's up in the attic,
digging it out.
One.
Nice.
And.
Don't fall.
I'm not gonna fall.
Careful on the ladder, there.
Collector helmets and masks on the back, and it has all the different characters.
Mm-hmm.
Don Post mask series.
Wow. Okay.
You're killing me. You're killing me, Kay. I just have this visual in my head of you climbing up a ladder, and now you're on your tummy, like climbing through, and you've got asbestos, and you're like, you just coughed a little bit.
Every week I would listen to you, and I would think, oh, now I wonder what that's worth.
You got to... Get your stuff out from the attic, but if you snap a picture, send it to the DuPage Facebook page. I'll definitely get you a price.
Yeah,
right.
At DuPage Picker on Facebook, and you can get a price. Kay,
thanks.
Be careful on the way down.
Right.
Okay.
Okie doke. Thanks.
Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
That was the best sound effects of all time.
All right.
You could hear it rustling ladder. Around. And then the breath got short. Yeah. I'm up in my head. All right. 847 says, I have a signed Ryan Sandberg baseball. Okay. Only difference is that it's an American League ball. That since he signed it at an All-Star game, does that make it worth less or more because of its quirk?
The only difference is the American League ball. I have found Ryan Sandberg signed All-Star ball. They didn't specify American League or not. Went for $75. Mm. So I don't think an American League ball would make it worth more.
Is that like an upside-down
stamp? I think it'd
be
about the same, right. I think it's going to be about the same, $75 to $100. But you never know. It could get a little bit more.
All right. Yeah. Okay. 312-981-7200. 312's got one here.
Okay.
I've got a soccer ball that I purchased about 2 years ago. It's got a Latin American team and has a signature on it, but I cannot make out the name.
All right. That,
do you have any suggestions on what I should do and how and where to get it verified?
I would research it if you can find the make of the ball. Sometimes they'll put the year and the make. If you just search that soccer ball, you'll probably find the various ones that had, you know,
who signed
signature,
it.
Yeah. Unless it's a fresh signature, live ink that he had someone else sign, a live, you know, a right, regular player. Right. But yeah, the best thing is just look up the year of the ball and the make, and you'll get the stock signature ones.
Is that on the Chinese calendar, the year of the ball?
right after year of the rooster.
Oh, the goofy.
Right.
All right, 312-981-7200. I still have in my mind.
I'm just glad we're not talking cassette singles.
I'm a little upset with Download Nation that no one is
right.
texting in with their cassingles.
Right.
Nobody's got another Bad Creation cassingle.
I was working at Musicland when those were the big deal.
Yeah, Belle Biv DeVoe was probably a cassingle.
Yep.
Maybe a Boys to Men.
Yep, Poison, all that.
Did the cassingle have kind of like a 45, like a B-side to it?
They did,
right?
Yeah, they did different B-sides. Yeah. You know, some bands were cool and they would put some different, you know, non-current album song on as the B-side, but yeah, I still collect them, you know, if I see the rock ones or heavy metal ones.
That's as the second half. We'll take a break single. To get Rob's news, but yeah, the second half, we better get a flood of singles. 312-981-7200. Greg Flam in studio or playing Swap Meet. Stay with us.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam.
Here I am.
There he is. It's the Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. Sponsored by Wolf's Flea Market. All right, we've got some people on the line. We got some text calling in. You know the drill. We're in the second half here of the swap meet. I'm a little upset as I see the texts and callers. No singles. Maybe nobody has any anymore.
Oh, I'll have to bring in some.
I feel like that's there's no way you'd throw away a single.
You know,
it's too valuable.
They just had the paper sleeve, so I could see they're easily damaged. Any moisture, the sleeve's gone, and then you're down to the cassette, and people just toss them.
The single.
Yeah, I'll break some in next week.
All right, let's go to lines. Hannah, what do you want to brag about, Hannah?
I have a Bucky Dent autograph. I just wanted to.
All right, you got the radio on? Turn the radio down.
Yankee Stadium.
You're getting a weird reverb.
Hello. Yes, can you hear me?
Well, you got a little double trouble there, Hannah, but she had a Bucky Dent 1975 autograph.
Signed ball, I think.
Signed ball,
right?
Yeah. Maybe she had two because of the echo. I couldn't tell.
She's giving her retirement speech now.
Yeah.
Who knows? I mean, some are asking 500, but
for Bucky Dent?
Yeah, they're asking that, but they're not.
What makes Bucky Dent? What makes Bucky Dent of all people?
He got so lucky. I mean,
Bucky Dent as a Yankee, right?
Yeah, and former White Sox, and even sports guys will tell you, hey, he just right time, right moment hit this home run in the World Series, and just made man after that, you know. Mm, the rest of his time wasn't that eventful with Yankees anyway. But
All right, 312-981-7200. Let's go to Ron. Ron, what do you want to brag about, Ron?
I have a baseball.
Oh, I love it.
We had Had three of them. My parents were Brewers baseball fans back in the early 70s.
Okay.
Okay.
They had connections with a sportscaster back then, and we have a ball signed by Hank Aaron, Warren Spahn, and Don Money.
Whoa.
Whoa, all on one, right?
Is it all one, or is it three different balls?
Three different balls.
Okay, that's better, yeah. We talked about the multiple awesome. Signatures, yeah. But, yeah, let me see what...
I like that. Warren Spahn. Yeah, Warren Spahn.
The only one we have is the Warren Spahn. The only thing is it's signed to my mom with Warren Spahn's name on it. We also have a picture of him signing the ball standing next to her.
Well, that that definitely helps as far as authenticating it. Yeah, I'm trying to find Warren Spahn.
Hey, you don't see a lot of Warren Spahn.
Right.
That's a good baseball name. I'm more particular, Ron, and you know this about me, but I'm more particular to the 80s baseball players. Mm-hmm. Spahn's a 70s guy. But, man, there's nothing better than an 80s baseball player name.
Signed Spahn balls are 70 and as low as 30.
All right.
That, yeah, okay. But that gives you a little start. If you, again, if you want to reach me, I'll price the other ones for you.
There you go.
Oh, the only problem is when she passed away, we cleaned her house out, and the only ball we found was the Warren Spahn one. We never found the other two.
Yeah, because I would think the Hank Aaron would probably be more than a Spahn, I would think.
She probably maybe she threw one of the balls to the neighborhood kid, and it's like, you need one?
The dog or something.
Yeah. Right.
It happens.
All right, thanks.
More like the dog got a hold of it.
Yeah,
right.
Dog. All right. Thanks, Ron.
Thanks for calling.
Guys.
Yep. All right. Let's keep going here. 312-981-7200. Got a lot of baseball tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go Tim. Tim's got baseball as well. What do you got, Tim?
Hey, I got two things. I have a baseball that's autographed by minor league ball player Charlie Poe, who was kicked off of the Birmingham Barons to make room for Michael Jordan when he started his minor league baseball career. I also have an authentic NFL football that's not signed by Jay Cutler. I'm pretty proud of that.
The football, yeah.
Cutler's going to go on to be the best broadcaster of all time. He's going to be, and we're all here in Chicago going to be like, huh. He has said no personality in Chicago, but he'll be a great broadcaster. And we'll be like, and you know what's going to happen too, Tim? And the NFL is not dumb, Fox. They're going to assign him to every single Bears game.
Right.
So, what's the worst is we're going to be sitting here going, let's go down to the sideline. Jay, you got an update on that injury? And be like, get him away from us.
So I have a question. Who was the guy that Jordan brought up from his high school days at his Hall of Fame speech? The guy that
Charlie
got
Poe.
Kicked off the team should get together and
a
radio.
Is there any in the quirk world of, sort of the idea of Charlie Poe getting kicked off for Jordan and he have an autographed baseball, does that mean anything?
That's probably a $10 item, I would think, $25.
Maybe. I like it. It's a good story.
It is a good story,
it's
and that's
cool
why we're here.
Yeah. That's what you brag about. Thanks, Tim.
Yep, thanks for calling.
All right, let's keep going here. Let's go to, I think we had this one before. I'm interested. Mike, what do you want to brag about, Mike?
I've got a 33 and a third RPM record from its gas station park back in the late 60s, I want to believe, or early 70s. Ernie Banks.
All the
describes what kind of pitches he likes and all that.
Yeah, the Ernie Ball. Yeah, I just
so
saw
what
that.
Does he do? It's an LP that they give away, and it's like just him talking.
Right, it's just him. It's a small 33 and a third RPM.
He's not like rapping or doing something. It's not
right.
Like an Eddie
That's
Murphy.
Not
it's not like Eddie Murphy when he did the party song.
I want to say I got Willie Mays and Don Drysdale and whatever guys were in that era, but Ernie Banks came up because he's a Cub.
Yeah,
and.
Okay.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Right, that's good.
No, I know what you're talking about. And looks like they go for about $13.
What?
But he did come out with quite a few records. I just saw one last week. He's on the Cub Power one. He did his own other, it was like a red album cover. I just saw that last week in an estate sale. Hmm. But anyway, he's done probably a handful of records.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Sure.
Thank you.
All right, let's keep going. 312-981-7200. Let's shift gears. Let's do something else besides baseball. Let's do John. John, what do you want to brag about, John?
Yeah, I have a figurine that you put on your table in the 50s,
like
a coffee table or something like that. And it's a black leopard with gold stripes.
Ooh, yeah.
It's an Art Deco figure.
Yes, I've seen those.
You have?
Yeah. About how big? Because I've seen them in
it's
various sizes.
Three inches inches high.
Okay.
And about 8 or 10 inches long.
Okay. And is this a lamp or just a figure?
No, just a figure.
Okay, yeah, because I've seen them both there as well. Let's see. I'm going to guess, while this is coming up, about $200 to $300.
Really?
Let me see.
So Ernie Banks puts a record out. He's get away from the gas.
Here we are again.
Bucks. John's got a black leopard figurine, and he's going to get rent money.
A few hundred, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm having trouble getting that going. Right.
Well, that sounds like a good haul, John.
Yeah, I've seen them before.
Who would buy it?
I have no idea.
It's pretty common, so I would compare others on eBay or whatever if you want to sell them, but you have to really pack that well because it's ceramic. So you might want to sell it either like at a garage sale or consignment, or put it on Craigslist or offer up so they pick it up from you so you don't have to worry about packing it.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, John.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
John can be that creepy guy that's like, you got to come to my house to get it.
See the black leopard. Right.
I'll tell you a quick story. When I was in, I guess I was an adult. I don't even know what do you call when you're 22. Is that adult? You're past college. Now you're just young adult. When I was a young adult,
right.
I had an apartment, and I remember I went to a flea market, and they had an incense holder that was a ceramic like that, but it was a woman's head, right?
All right.
So it was black ceramic, and it was African American head maybe.
Okay.
And you'd put the incense in the middle, and then it would look like she was exhaling smoke out of her mouth.
Hmm.
Now, what would that be going, especially after I broke her in half?
And now you're putting it in the spot.
I think I got it for $5. Yeah, and after I broke it, I think there were several partygoers that got cut by the ceramic.
Yeah, sometimes clean break, you can crazy glue that, you know.
I tried. Right. I tried everything I could to keep it alive.
I have a toilet cigarette lighter. I'd probably put those two together and bundle it. But yeah.
The bundle. 312-981-7200.
What are you going to do?
All right. Mike's on the line. Bob's on the line. Ian's on the line. We got some great texts that are coming in. We'll get to them all tonight. 312-981-7200. Swap meet. Stay with us. It's a swap meet. Greg Flam's in studio at DuPage Picker on Facebook and Twitter. Taking your calls and texts. See what your junk is worth. Also, what you just want to brag about. Speaking of bragging, 847 came through.
Yes.
Looks like they just took a picture. They sent a picture of about 15 Kasingles. Probably not worth anything, but the best text of the night. I wish I could give you... Well, I wish you could give my collection of Kasingles. But you have... Listen to these songs, you guys. Samantha Fox, classic. Mm-hmm. Luther Vandross, of course. Mm-hmm. Queen. Will to Power? Is that it? Mm-hmm. Ooh, baby, I love you, way.
Which is
a Frampton cover.
Right.
Roxette.
Mm-hmm.
The Bangles.
Yes.
U2 with B.B. King.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the Angels of Harlem?
Yeah.
And a couple others. My favorite, though, FYC. She drives me crazy. She drives me crazy.
Nice.
Awesome. 847, you made my night.
Yes.
Made my night.
Now I don't have to bring him in next week.
I'm going to Apple Music on the way home tonight. I'm going to be like, hey, John, me, crazy. I'm going to get a lift on the way home. I'm going to be like, can you please play Fine Young Cannibals for me, please? Thank you. No, you can keep your water. I just like Fine Young Cannibals right now. All right, 312-981-7200. Mike, what do you got? What do you want to brag about?
Hey, good evening. I want to brag about, I have a Mitchell transistor radio in the box.
Wow.
And it says 1954 on there, Chicago 26.
Chicago 26.
And it's in great shape.
Wow, that seems like a find.
Yeah, I'm wondering if that Chicago 26 is the model, because there were so many different Mitchell radios, some as high as...
No, it's 1101 model, 1101.
Okay, good,
but,
yeah.
The 26, I think, was like the zip code now.
Okay, yeah. Let's see.
But it's in great shape.
Some are as high as 438. I'm having trouble finding the 26 model.
1101
rather. I'm sorry. Yeah, I do have that in here. What color is it? There's different colors.
It's got like a
blue or
leatherette case. It's got leather. It looks like leather.
Okay.
On the sides and the back. And in the front, it's chrome with you know, like a grill on
there. Sure. Okay. I think you're looking at about $60 to $70.
Okay.
Could be more with the case. Yeah, but
that's not a lot of money.
That's just a radio.
Yeah, the case is built into the radio.
Okay. Yeah. So. Yeah, that I think you're still in that range there because it looks like any of the models.
I would have thought it'd be a lot more, buddy.
Yeah.
Sorry, Mike.
Yeah.
That's a
first
bummer.
Transistor.
Yeah, one here, right? You know, $30. I'm seeing the exact one you're talking about with the leather case that wraps around it.
Wow. Okay, great.
All right, yeah, thanks, Mike. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
The Roxette single is the look.
Yep.
You got the look.
Yep.
Great stuff, man. There's some great. I mean, I'm. While you were talking to Mike there, I was just like looking closer at the picture right. of all these, the Escape Club.
Yeah. Wild Wild West.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wild. I'm more partial
to. Get it ready, Pete.
Bumper. I'm more partial to the Kool Moe Dee Wild Wild West than the Escape Club, but, you know,
right.
hey.
You know.
Let's go to Ian. Ian, what do you want to brag about, Ian?
All right. I have a 1994 autographed book. Soccer ball from the USA national team
wow.
when the World Cup was played here in the first game in Chicago.
Wow. That was a great World Cup. The mm-hmm. U.S. did not do well, if I do not remember.
Nope.
Right?
But he never do well, so don't worry about that.
They're doing better lately than they were back then.
We can go on and go on, but they're not
right.
doing well.
Let's talk about the ball, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
What's a 1994 soccer ball autographed by the team?
I see a couple here selling that have sold for $25 to $200 in that range, signed. Mm-hmm. So that's by the U.S. team.
Yeah, that's no good.
No, this is by the U.S. team, that's fine, but this is 94. It's a first edition.
Yeah.
Right, that's what I have here. World Cup USA 1994, FIFA size. Signed ball, $25 is sold for plus shipping.
You kidding me?
Nope, not kidding you.
Sorry, buddy.
And then there's another one here that was $200, best offer taken.
Hmm. Don't hold on to it. Just all hold right, on, to Ian. Just hold on to it. Don't freak out.
If you want to send a picture, I'll.
I'm not freaking out.
Don't freak out. Last thing you want to do. In this case,
no, I'm not freaking out about it. Trust me on this one. I'm just hanging on to it.
Yeah.
Hang on. When the U.S. win the World Cup.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Grand will benefit.
All right.
That's right. All right. Good.
Cool.
Thanks, Ian.
Well, thanks
right.
for calling, Ian. Awesome.
I love that optimism.
Yep.
There you go. 765 is like, I'll buy that transistor.
Mm-hmm.
See? That's the next iteration of the swap meet where we start to get, like, it becomes like a game show. You know, like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where you get like some dramatic music and we get
right.
two people on there like, I'll take the transistor. Dong. And you're like, how much does he want the transistor for?
Sure.
That'll be the next version.
And we can do like a swap meet where you want to swap box number one with box number
yeah,
three.
Right.
And we can incorporate that, like make a deal ending.
All right. Let's see. Here we go. Any value to these unopened Aerosmith t-shirts from the 70s?
Nice.
From my dad's record store, 847 says this.
That's awesome. First off, get any other stuff that was in your dad's record store, get that and keep it. Those shirts should easily be 100 to 175 each. I mean, sealed. I saw the picture
wow.
you sent in the bag. That's
more
awesome.
More than the transistor radio. From
that's a yeah. How many did he have?
The
there, like five t-shirt. Of them or something.
It's like, the Aerosmith T-shirt beats out the 1954 transistor radio.
Yeah.
In the box.
Yeah.
What Sorry. World are we living in?
I know.
What happened here?
I know. It's a wacky pack world.
2017. 847. I have a piece of paper with Michael Jordan's signature on it, along with a ticket stub, and my picture with him from April of 1985. Is it worth anything?
Yeah, that's just going to be a typical Jordan signature,
yeah.
you know.
We got a lot of those.
Yeah, and there's so many.
All right, last one tonight. You ready for this?
Yes.
815. I have the Holy Grail of Jimmy Buffett albums.
Yeah, I got to get
Havana
that.
Daydreaming. It was an album that was never supposed to be released because in the track that was supposed to be have the song Big Rig, instead has a song called Please Take Your Drunken 15-Year-Old Girlfriend Home.
Okay.
Classic Buffett.
Nice.
Again, many believe this album is urban folklore and doesn't exist, but I have it in my possession, purchased at a resale shop back when I was in college at Eastern, circa 1978, 1979. Daydream Havana Daydreaming. Does that show up?
It does. And oddly enough, someone sold that with another record for only $3. So either the seller didn't know what it was and they just did like a buy yeah. now price and didn't know, or I'm trying to find some other ones.
That's fascinating.
It is rare. It is a rare album.
But that, again, if you're not going to get money off, it's a great story. It's something to brag about saying, right. Look what I got. You guys want to hear, take your 15, your drunken 15-year-old girlfriend home?
Yeah, it is rare. There's none on here, so I just can't tell you.
Wow, interesting. But yeah. All right, well, there you go. There's another successful swap meet tonight. Mm-hmm. Thank you, everyone, for playing. Sorry I didn't get to some of the other texts that were on there. Try again next week. Greg Flam, at DuPage Picker at Facebook and Twitter, joins us every Wednesday for the swap meet. Greg, great to see you, buddy.
Great to see you. Thanks.
Fun show tonight. Patty Vasquez coming up. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio. Tomorrow night, retiring Cook County Clerk David Orr is going to sit down with me at the big table, talk about his almost 40-year career in Chicago Cook County politics. I mean, he was a clerk for years, since 1990, but he also served as one of Chicago's mayors. He had a 7-day stint after the death of Harold Washington, where he was the mayor of Chicago. So we'll talk with the Cook County clerk about voting, about politics, about just his point of view as he gets out of the game and retires from public service, right? I mean, he should be very candid about what he thinks of the situation in Illinois. So we'll do that tomorrow night.